You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Steve McEwen. Steve was a radio operator in the 4th Infantry Division of the U.S. Army in Vietnam in 1966 and 67. He was a founding member of the Veterans for Peace chapter number 27 in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and is the coordinator for their newsletter. Steve McEwen has spoken to hundreds of classes in elementary and high schools, colleges, churches, and community groups on matters of war and peace, and he has been part of organizing all kinds of peace activism, some of which I've been involved with, including related to Armistice Day, the 100th anniversary of which was this past Sunday. Steve McEwen, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thanks, David.
So what is Armistice Day for anyone who still hasn't heard, and why should we be celebrating it?
Well, Armistice Day was on November 11th, 1918, at the 11th hour. Fighting stopped by order of the Allied troops, the Germans, and the Austria countries. It had been signed at 5 o'clock, but the fighting was supposed to stop. And all along the Western Front, a silence had happened. In the trenches, with the blood, the rats, the corpses, the barbed wire.
Yeah.
After 4 years of fighting with the 10 million dead in the military, another probably 8 million civilians killed, and 20 million wounded, and God only knows how many, some say upwards of 100 million, with the Asiatic flu that was attributed to the war.
Right.
War had stopped. There was a silence on the battlefield. War had had its day. It was called and fought as the War to End Wars. And as you well know, David, it wasn't called World War I until World War II came along. It was called the War for Democracy and the War to End Wars. And we as Veterans for Peace would like to see that name change, Veterans Day. Change back to Armistice Day, which is supposed to be a day of peace, and we can get into that.
And it was a holiday related to peace, even officially, according to the U.S. Congress, it was a holiday for peace, was it not?
Yes, it was set aside, I believe, in 25, the first real recognition of it. Well, it was called Armistice Day, and they did some activities there at the Arlington Cemetery. But in 1938, it was set aside by law of Congress to promote world peace. It was called Armistice Day. And then in 1954, it was changed to Veterans Day. The one word was changed over to Veterans Day, replacing Armistice Day. And so that doesn't seem like offhand, like a big deal. But again, we have to go back to what that war was, the War to End Wars. And a lot of people took that serious after World War I. And, of course, the biggest peace movement, as you've well written in a book, took place and culminated in the Kellogg-Briand Pact in 1927. And with that, war was outlawed. And so with the 1954 declaration of Armistice Day that General Eisenhower signed into law, changing that, the emphasis started to be put more on Veterans Day. We in Veterans for Peace felt that it came about because, and others do too, it came about because of our World War II and the Korean War. It was pretty hard to refer back to Armistice Day. The War to End Wars, and a day of peace after having these terrible carnages take place. It was brought about by a World War II veteran named Raymond Weeks, who, right after he got back, he's from one of the southern states, Mississippi or Alabama. I think it was Alabama, but at any rate, he really pushed for it for many years to change that to Veterans Day. He wanted to have all veterans honored. And, of course, with the communist scare, the Cold War heating up, this made a lot of sense to the powers that be, and it was signed into law. And then later, Weeks was recognized by President Ronald Reagan in the 80s, given a Medal of Citation for his work. I think he was even called an American hero. So we as Veterans for Peace want to put that emphasis back.
Yeah, I mean, the emphasis, when people hear Veterans Day, they don't think pro-war holiday. But the fact is that in many places it is, and even chapters of Veterans for Peace have a hard time getting included in Veterans Day parades in some cities because they're for peace, right?
Yes, they've been excluded. I think it comes to mind three chapters of Veterans for Peace, one in Boston, one out of Seattle, and I think in the past Milwaukee has been excluded too. In Boston, they've marched for years at the end of the parade, after the parade.
Yeah.
Been excluded because they've been called too political. Quite funny because all the other veterans organizations, of course, they're not, you know, with the pro-war, and they couldn't have the insignias or the flags march along with the parade. Veterans for Peace couldn't, but of course, the other veterans for organizations. And Veterans for Peace didn't want to get into a big flack about not having the other veterans organizations belong, but they rightfully felt, and a lot of other people along the routes that the parades took place, felt that they should have been included.
Yeah, because it's... The way that people have been brought to think in recent years, if you're not for the troops, there's something wrong with you. But for the troops usually means for the wars, unless you raise questions about that, and then it doesn't mean anything at all. To my mind, it's a pro-war holiday now, and it used to be a pro-peace holiday. Do people ask you, you know, how do you dare oppose Veterans Day?
Well, that's a good question, David. And we go back to the veterans that we talked about that I mentioned right away, the military. It was a great war. Yes, it was a great war in terms of the casualties. It was an industrial slaughter. A book that I'd highly recommend, written by Adam Hochschild. I've read the whole thing called To End All Wars, just the senseless destruction of all of this, how it came about, and how do we honor those veterans? You know, this is where the holiday came about, Armistice Day again.
Right.
How do we honor those that came before us? And that's a very personal matter with me and a lot of other veterans. My grandfather, who I lived with, was with the enlisted in the... in Canada with the French-Canadian Army at the age of 30. I lived with him before Vietnam and after Vietnam. He had nightmares. He was wounded in that war. He had a wooden leg. He didn't get that from the war. He got shot in the rear end. He got that in a hunting accident, but his stump would jump at night. And out of the blue sometimes, he would tell me about the smell. And he was no warmonger. He would tell me about the smell of dead bodies. He would tell me about cooling off his machine gun with urine. He was wounded in Belgium.
Yeah.
And spent some time in the hospital. So, like I said, it's very personal for me and a lot of others. And so how do we honor those veterans? Here in Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nebraska, all the way down to Kansas, and Iowa in between, and North Dakota, there's something that was called called the Armistice Day Blizzard of 1940. I don't know, David, have you heard of that?
I wanted to ask you about that because I don't know about it and you had mentioned it.
Okay. It's still called that. 145 people died during that blizzard. The temperature was like 60 degrees, balmy. Duck hunters were out along the Mississippi River here in Minnesota. People were on Lake Michigan. 60 people died on there alone. A storm came up suddenly. They got 29 inches up in by St. Cloud here in Minnesota. It came up suddenly, and people were stranded all over. A lot of people died in that, like I said, 145. It's still called the Armistice Day Blizzard. Now, if you were to call that the Veterans Day Blizzard, people would look at you like you were pretty strange. I mean, the people that, you know what it means, the Armistice Day Blizzard.
Right.
And so one might ask, logically speaking, why wasn't that changed if it's so important? You know? Well, obviously that doesn't honor veterans, of course, but is it really about honoring veterans? And I succinctly bring up the question, how do we honor those veterans that fought the war and wars? And we as a chapter of Veterans for Peace, Chapter 27 out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, I think we were the first chapter to start remembering the armistice calling it.
You started like this in 1987, right?
Yes, 1987. We went out to, we walked, had a 20-mile walk. We had arranged for this in advance. The Native American Ojibwe, the late Native American Ojibwe pipe carrier, Larry Cloud Morgan, went with us. He was one of the four plowshares activists that jackhammered a nuclear missile silo in down in Missouri in the early 80s. And he was out of jail, and he went with us, and our small chapter at the time. And we walked from Flandreau, South Dakota, where Little Crow was grave at. We walked from there to Pipestone National Monument, where for thousands of years Native Americans have gathered for peace. It's a neutral place, and they were guaranteed free passage. protection to come there to quarry their pipes and to smoke them for peace. And so we walked there and had a ceremony. We didn't ring bells that time. We had a pipe ceremony, and it was a bunch of people. We had like about 100 different signs. My mother, I grew up on that area about 40 miles away, and my mother arranged for us to speak at the South Dakota State, the Newman Center there, at 5 different Catholic masses. And the priest, after he heard us speak, invited me up to a small parish, a small town that I played basketball against. So I went into that church basement, and a lot of women are down there. They're having a chicken dinner and getting clothes for, I believe, Standing Rock Indian Reservation at the time. I probably played basketball against their sons or maybe their husbands. I was 40 or so at the time. And when I started out speaking, I said about the walk that we were promoting and why it should be called Armistice Day. I told them that it ought to be, this is the Catholic Church, mind you, that it ought to be a holy day of obligation. And their jaws about dropped. I don't know how familiar you are, David, or your audience with the Catholic Church, but there's a number of days that are called holy days of obligation, such as Christmas, Easter, which you're supposed to go to Mass like that. The Church, and observe it.
Yeah.
And as the writer Kurt Vonnegut has said in The Breakfast of Champions, Kurt Vonnegut being a prisoner of war during World War II, and as a writer and interviewed many World War I veterans, spoke about that day at the 11th hour, the 11th month on the battlefields, about the silence there, where he said that the veterans swore they heard the voice of God. So one can just imagine that in the silence right there. And I integrated it with what I said about a holy day of obligation. And we as a chapter started ringing those bells in 1991 out at Fort Snelling National Cemetery out of Minneapolis here, a very large cemetery with thousands, hundreds of thousands of graves. My name's on that because my first wife died early of breast cancer. We went out there during a blizzard in 91 for Armistice Day, about a dozen of us, and we rang bells. And we've been doing it ever since. at various locations involving the community, some as many as 500-600 people with school kids. I even read the Kellogg-Briand Pact in the mid-90s, which you're well familiar with, that outlaws wars. Children read it along with us. And so we've been holding these ceremonies, and we integrated into during the year, which I think is important at special occasions. We've done it when it's our time to go instead of the 21-gun volley salute, which,
and
you hear the contrast of the pen versus the sword. Well, this is like the bell versus the gun. And so it's sort of a cultural thing for us, too.
Steve, you've also told me that in the early 90s, the first President Bush had a comment that you objected to that fit very well into reforming the current war culture back into a pro-peace culture. What was that?
Yes, that was President H.W. Bush, who made, of course, the comment shortly after Desert Storm that we certainly have kicked the, I think he kicked the donkey with the A word out of the Vietnam syndrome. Don't quote me word for word on that, but the meaning is there. He also said later on that year that sometimes we have to have a war to end wars. So that's why we started the bell ring. And that's why we continue it.
To have a peace to end wars.
Yeah.
And this idea that your chapter started in Minnesota of restoring Armistice Day and the ceremonies that, and the ringings of the bells, I mean, you've started a trend. This has been catching on through Veterans for Peace and many other groups, hasn't it?
Well, it certainly has, and I'm really pleased to see it. And a lot of that credit goes to the late Bob Heberle, who, I'm not sure exactly what year, passed a resolution at one of our national conventions to start reclaiming. Didn't use those words, and I don't know what the official words were, but put the emphasis on naming it Armistice Day. And I know some chapters have started because of that. In Iowa City, for example, it started two chapters because of it. Has a successful Armistice Day.
Chapters of Vets for Peace.
Yes.
Yeah. And you've had hundreds of churches ringing bells and the local governments endorsing the holiday and so forth. I mean, how far along has this gotten toward acceptance and public awareness?
Well, it's gathering. We don't know the full extent of that. In 2011, of course, you know, the jingle 11-11-11, 2011, we had close to 200 churches that we know of ring bells, and many of them put in their bulletins or announced to their congregations what it was about. And we asked them to work and pray for peace. Well, obviously, there's more prayers to be done and more work to be done, but associating that with Armistice Day, I think, was a big step. We've continued to have done that. We recently had the Archbishop of Minnesota, and I think it goes into North Dakota and South Dakota. I'm not sure. It's the diocese. And if I may, could I just read this short letter?
Yeah, by all means.
That we received. This is to our vice president of our chapter, Mike McDonald, who went over to the Archdiocese located in St. Paul, right up the hill. You can see it right from Kellogg Boulevard, who the street is named after, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for the law against war, the Kellogg-Briand Pact. I just had to put that in there. Dear Mike, thank you for your recent request for me to notify our parishes about the Armistice Day church bell ringing effort organized by Veterans for Peace, Chapter 27. Many, if not most, of our parishes and schools regularly pray for an end to war and for all of our brothers and sisters to welcome Jesus, our Prince of Peace, into their hearts. I support your efforts to reclaim Armistice Day, to educate all people as to its history and the ultimate goal of world peace. In consultation with the Archdiocese Office of Worship, I'm asking our office communications to send to our Polish parish bulletin editors information on the bell ringing effort and a short announcement to print in their bulletins if they see fit. I'm confident many of our parishes will participate and, most importantly, pray for peace. Please know of my gratitude for your efforts and my continued prayers for peace and all those who seek it. It's from the Reverend Bernard A. Hebda, Archbishop of St. Paul in Minneapolis. I think that's significant because here we find a clergy leader doing some of our work that we've been doing.
Yeah.
Helping us along the road. And this is what we want. And the same thing happened. I don't have the proclamation in front of us, but at the last city council meeting, the full city council in front of the full chamber and the mayor signed a proclamation along the same lines, except they weren't going to pray for peace, but, you know, to issue that they support the armistice thing.
Well, I think
so that's some good news there. And
you've set a real example, Steve, that other groups, World Beyond War, that I work with, and other peace organizations have picked up and are promoting, not just in the United States, but in other countries that still call it Armistice Day or that call it Remembrance Day, but where it's also become very much a pro-war celebration. This idea, I think, has legs. I think it's going to continue to spread. When you go and talk to young people in schools about Armistice Day and about peace and war, what sort of reception do you find from them?
Pretty much without, I shouldn't say without exception. There's always, you know, sometimes you know, you get somebody that's really had it ingrained to them, you know, by their family that, you know, we're almost the devils or something. But we've had good receptions with young people. We speak, well, from our experience also, from war and what it does, and about the armistice in specific, specifically, I try and gear that in with the Christmas truce, which I think is really, really related. And the Christmas truce, of course, being, and I think many of your audience probably have heard of it, but I'll just repeat it. It's a story that I didn't know was really true. I thought it was an old soldier story, and that's
right.
What I spoke about in 1987 when we went on our Pipestone Walk, our first Armistice Day. I said that story, and I said, use your imagination about what this could be. That story in itself really captures the young people's imagination right there, and they really, really relate to it. And we relate to it in our own chapter, Veterans for Peace, like when we have disagreements and that sort of thing, we say, if these guys during that Christmas truce could go out in the no man's land, we can work our stuff out. And I think that's a very strong message. I think it's universal.
It's a very powerful message, and it's wonderful for people to understand that it really happened, that it's really true. And I think that's a great tool to use when there are disagreements within the peace movement, as there are an incredibly frustrating amount of the time, to know that that people who've been pitted against each other as enemies to the death can make peace. What can people do to find out about how to promote Armistice Day? Where can they go online or elsewhere to find Veterans for Peace Chapter 27 or National Veterans for Peace or other resources?
All of the above, David. That, and I'm sure that you're, I read your excellent article here, special armistice issue put out, Reclaim Armistice Day, where you wrote an article on a peace to end all wars. It's one of the better articles, I must say, that I've read.
Was that the one from The Humanist?
No, this one is from National Veterans for Peace publication.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You got Tarek.
And I called down because I had wanted to distribute some of those, and all they could send me was like 15 at the time. I think they're going to print much more. They just went off the shelves.
That's great. It's a wonderful newspaper.
Yes, it is. And
newspaper.
That's part of the good news right there.
How can people get that paper, Steve?
Office building in the world, the Pentagon, you know.
Steve, how can people get that newspaper that Vets for Peace puts out?
Well, I would just Google Veterans for Peace, and you can get a hold of the national office. That would be the best way.
Yeah. World Beyond War also has totally picked up this idea of Armistice Day as a day to do events and promote peace, and we've got... if you go to worldbeyondwar.org/Armistice Day, you'll find lots of links, including to Veterans for Peace web pages and resources and bell ringing instructions and all the rest of it. I think it's a terrific thing. We got just a couple minutes left. What you mentioned, Frank Kellogg and the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Is that going to continue to be a big part of what you guys are doing for peace in Minnesota?
Yes, it is. We have to figure out what to do on, of course, August 27th each year. And, of course, we've done things with you on that. But we take it into schools. We give it. I gave it here. I was on part of the Nobel Peace Prize forum here at Augsburg College, the second largest one in the world other than the one where they actually give the prize. And we had Beatrice Finn from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons.
Right.
And at the closing ceremony, I was part of the panel with her for our work that we've done with the End War Committee, with Women Against Military Madness and Veterans for Peace. It's part of the committee there, a panel discussion. And in front of the audience, I presented her with the Kellogg-Briand Pact. More people get to learn about that, and she was just touched with it.
As was I when you presented me with a nice canvas copy of it. That's I tried to turn around and lost my microphone there. That's on the wall behind me here.
Okay. Yeah, we give it to a lot of times to schools. We gave it to our peace essay contest winners in high schools that we run with the Minnesota Alliance with Peacemakers that we're a part of, and of course, you've given it to down in Chicago, where you've been a couple of times as the keynote speaker, and all kinds of events that we possibly can. As a matter of fact, we gave it to a school named after Frank Kellogg here in Minnesota,
yeah.
Called Kellogg Junior High, and we gave one to a Veterans for Peace chapter out in Washington. They presented it on an Armistice Day ceremony a couple years ago to the school itself that's named after Frank Kellogg. So
there's a couple of wonderful peace ideas that people can go learn more about, the Kellogg-Briand Pact and Armistice Day, and they can go to Veterans for Peace Chapter 27 out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Veterans for Peace, the national and international organization. We've been speaking with Steve McEwen, who was a founding member of VFP Chapter 27, which started this practice of restoring Armistice Day that is on the way to restoring it. I wish we could go on, but are out of time. Steve, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks. Keep up the good work, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, elections highlight corporate news media's partisan prism, the insistence on reading things preeminently in terms of what they mean for the fortunes of one major party or the other, and calling a good story one that lets them trade claims. But as one of the key times in which people visibly engage with power, there's hardly a time more important than elections for media to stop splitting the difference and frankly describe the impact of elections, not just the outcomes, but the processes on people and their ability to have a say in their circumstances. We'll talk about what the 2018 midterms told us about voting in this country with Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones and the author, most recently, of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, out now in paperback. Also on the show, quote, in a setback for the Trump administration, a federal judge has blocked a permit for construction of the Keystone XL oil pipeline from Canada and ordered officials to conduct a new environmental review, close quote. Well, that's the Associated Press's lead on a story about a U.S. district judge's ruling that the Trump White House was not within bounds to simply ignore years of data on the impact of the Keystone extension on the climate, indigenous communities, and endangered species in summarily scrapping Obama's veto on pipeline construction. AP's not wrong that the decision is a setback for Trump's agenda, but when life itself is a factor in a news event, you'd hope reporters would now and again make it the subject of a sentence. We'll talk about what the ruling on Keystone XL could mean, short-term and long-term, with Jackie Prang, senior attorney and managing litigator with the Natural Resources Defense Council. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. You can read analysis all day long about the effect of the 2018 midterm elections on Republicans, on Democrats, on Congress, and on Donald Trump. But in an election that saw broken voting machines, overheated machines, missing machines, confusion over absentee ballots, over provisional ballots, long lines, someone needs to be looking out for what the midterms meant and mean for people. We are joined now by Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter at Mother Jones and author of, most recently, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, out now in paperback. Ari Berman, welcome back to Counterspin.
Hey, Janine. Thanks for having me back.
So we're recording this on November 15th. Not even everything from the midterms is absolutely settled. There are lots of things we could talk about, but let's start, I guess, with Florida and Georgia, places where the races have been very, very tight and have gone to recount. From the perspective of somebody who's focused on voting and on every vote counting, are there particular lessons or questions or concerns coming out of those two states for you right now?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions and concerns about both states. And the issues are a little bit different in the two places, but there's a lot of similarity too. I mean, in Georgia, you had a Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, who was also running for governor, essentially overseeing his own election, who put in place a number of restrictive policies, from aggressively purging the voter rolls to putting thousands of people on pending registration lists, to counties aggressively rejecting absentee ballots, to closing polling places, to very, very long lines, 4-hour lines. in Atlanta, all of which created a lot of confusion and a lot of people not being able to vote or counting disputed ballots. And now that's a very, very close election that may or may not go to a runoff. But you're looking at, you know, Kemp is up by 55,000 votes. He's about 17,000 votes away from going to a runoff. And you're wondering, you know, if there are thousands of people who are disenfranchised or potentially disenfranchised, that seems to have had at least some impact on the election. In Florida, what happened is basically the governor's race and the Senate race were very close, and Republicans started making totally outlandish claims about voter fraud, even though there was no evidence of fraud, because they didn't want to count every vote. And now we're learning there was a lot of problems with the election there, too. There were over 20,000 absentee ballots that were rejected. And so it looks like there, in Georgia, the kind of question is the count in the first place an accurate count because of people disenfranchised? In Florida, it's a question of, are we even going to count all the votes? Because Republicans keep trying to stop the count before we even get to a recount. And so I think in both states, there's just a lot of questions about the fairness and validity of the elections.
Well, and in terms of coverage, and I'll just stick with Florida for a second, the idea of, well, Republicans are saying there might be fraud and charges and countercharges. And then I'm reading a kind of story that basically says, well, yeah, here's why it would be the GOP strategy to do this. They basically are trying to work the recount the way they see it as another campaign. All of it seems to kind of devolve voting down to like very small p politics. And I'm just wondering, because what you might come away with is a pox on both their houses. And that's not really an appropriate takeaway, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, this has been a strategy entirely driven by Republicans. In Georgia, they drove a strategy to make it harder for people to vote, particularly for people that might have supported Stacey Abrams in her bid to become the first black woman governor. I mean, pretty much every restrictive voting law that Brian Kemp put into place disproportionately affected African-American, Latino, Asian-American voters who were far more likely to support Stacey Abrams. And in Florida, what they've done is they've just had a strategy all along to raise doubts about the count so that there is no recount. I mean, essentially, they have said that they don't want every vote to count. And so the strategy is a little bit different in both states, because right now, Brian Kemp is kind of a little bit further removed from the process now that he has finally resigned as Secretary of State. Was Rick Scott is both governor of Florida and a Senate candidate, so he remains very enmeshed in these two things. But I think overall in both places, there's a thought that really the Republicans there just don't want all the votes to count, that Republicans in Georgia don't want disputed absentee ballots, disputed provisional ballots to count, and same thing in Florida. They don't want disputed absentee ballots to count. They don't want this to go to a recount. But you can't just view this as a technical political dispute. You have to view this in the larger context of the Republican Party has been committed to making it harder to vote, and they have put in place very restrictive policies in places like Georgia and Florida that it's made it harder to do so.
Well, I was just going to say, this isn't coming out of nowhere. We have talked in the past about suppressive measures that tend to restrict people's ability to vote, things like exact match signatures and things like that. But it's part of a history, and that history has always been lopsided in terms of who is trying to cut people out.
It is. And I mean, there's a very long history in this country. You can go back a long way and look at voter disenfranchisement. But just more recently, if you look, 24 states had new voting restrictions in effect for the 2018 election. That means nearly half the states in the country had one law or another that made it harder to vote. You also had the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act in 2013, ruling that states with a long history of discrimination no longer needed to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That allowed Georgia, for example, to put in place a lot of suppressive voting laws that would have otherwise been blocked. And so I think between the restrictions passed by Republicans and then the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act, I feel like states like Georgia felt like they had a free hand to just discriminate against people. And then you had the added dimension of candidates that had put in place suppressive voting laws overseeing their own elections, which was just a fundamental conflict of interest that certainly swayed votes towards one candidate in Georgia at the expense of another.
Well, another kind of bigger picture issue, Amendment 4 in Florida, about returning the vote to those who've served time on felony convictions. Long term, That sounds like something that's significant.
Yeah, there was some good news amidst all the suppression. A half dozen states passed ballot initiatives that will make it easier to vote. Florida passed a ballot initiative that could restore voting rights to up to 1.4 million ex-felons, which is a huge number of people. Michigan and Nevada and Maryland passed reforms like automatic registration and election day registration that will make it easier to register to vote. Three different states, Colorado, Michigan, and Missouri, passed independent redistricting commissions. So, I mean, you had both in purple and in red states, voters coming out and supporting initiatives to make it easier to vote, which led me to believe that there's actually a lot of support in this country for making voting more convenient, for expanding voting access, and that whereas the politicians, the Brian Kemps and the Rick Scotts of the world, want to restrict voting rights, I think among the public, even among many Republicans, there is support for a broad pro-democracy agenda, that people think that if you've made a mistake, you should get a second chance to vote. They think that people should have opportunities to register to vote to make it easy and convenient. They think that you should have more time to vote in terms of early voting. They don't think that politicians should be drawing their own districts. I mean, there's a lot of support for a pro-democracy agenda, and that gets missed a lot of times in all the coverage of the suppression that Republicans are doing, because those are Republican officials, but then there's something of a disconnect between the electorate more broadly and what politicians in charge are doing.
Well, absolutely. And if we do have the GOP playing a very long game and a very multi-front game, another front of that that I know that you've talked about is the census. And I would just pick up on the fact that, as you're saying, folks are on to them. You know, there is an awareness of the coherence of these various measures that vote suppressors are taking, you know, and there's a fight back to it. But could you talk a little bit about the relationship that the census plays here, because it fits right in?
This is a really critical fight right now, because the Trump administration added a question about U.S. citizenship to the census for the first time since 1950. There's a lot of fear that that will depress response rates from immigrant communities, from non-citizens. If that happens, that means that areas with lots of immigrants, with lots of non-citizens, diverse areas like California and New York and Texas will receive fewer resources. They'll receive less political representation. They won't potentially count for redistricting purposes after the 2020 redistricting process. And so the census has come to the GOP's long game for rigging democracy, because the census determines how $675 billion in federal funding is spent. It determines how legislative districts are drawn. It determines how many electoral votes states get. And if you start manipulating the census to try to make certain areas, certain communities have less power, then American democracy itself gets fundamentally skewed. And so this is really their strategy post-2020. And I think their strategy for trying to keep power in the face of massive demographic change, because if you just don't count people, if you just say these people don't exist even though they are here, you can deny them really significant economic and political resources. And I think that's really what they're trying to do with adding this question to the census, which is now being litigated. There was just a trial in New York, and there's going to be other trials challenging this. So it's a little under the radar at the moment, given all the other election stuff, but I think the census is a really critical long-term fight for our democracy.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I do feel that there's been a spotlight on the process of voting. You know, we at FAIR, we've seen, for example, media doing that same thing of saying long lines of people waiting to vote, but then other people saying, wait a minute, long lines actually are not a sign of, you know, a healthy democracy. That's actually a problem. You know, I do see more focus on the process itself. But what would you like to see journalists following up on? We know that they're very race-focused, they're very outcome-focused, but there's a lot left on the ground here in terms of democracy itself that they could be reporting out right now.
I do. I mean, I think the coverage in 2018 was better than 2016. I think a lot of people just got sidetracked by the Trump reality show in 2016 and didn't focus on the voter suppression we were seeing in Wisconsin and North Carolina and Texas and other states. I think when you removed Trump from the equation a little bit, then when you just had such blatant suppression efforts in states like Georgia, for example, people began to cover it more closely. But I do worry about false equivalence here. I do worry about media saying, well, you know, Democrats are alleging voter suppression and Republicans are alleging voter fraud and treating this as a both sides issue, when in fact we know definitively there was voter suppression in the election and there was no voter fraud. And so I think if this is covered as a he said, she said partisan issue, that is very problematic. I think we have to be very clear here with what's happening, which is that Republicans deliberately implemented a strategy to make it harder to vote in states like Georgia, that may have allowed them to win the election. And I think it needs to be covered like that. And then I think, you know, when there's all of this crazy rhetoric about voter fraud, I think you have to clearly say this is false. There's no evidence of this. This is a political strategy. You can't just say Trump alleges mass voter fraud and put that in a tweet when people aren't going to read the fifth paragraph saying this isn't true. And so I think the narrative has to be very clearly that this isn't true, this is a lie, and that Republicans are manufacturing this lie to try to build support for even more restrictive voting efforts to help them win in future elections. So I think the media is getting better at covering this, but I don't think they're there yet.
We've been speaking with Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter at Mother Jones, and he's author of, most recently, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, which is out now in paperback. Ari Berman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine. I appreciate it.
One of the first things Donald Trump did upon taking office was to reverse the Obama administration's permit rejection for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would move crude from oil sands in Canada to Oklahoma and the Gulf Coast. Restarting work on this extension of the existing Keystone pipeline, along with greenlighting the likewise hotly contested Dakota Access pipeline, was part of what one newspaper called Trump's ambitious plans for a U.S. makeover. A federal judge has just blocked construction on Keystone XL again, however, seeming to suggest essentially that Trump's because I want to reasoning was insufficiently persuasive. Here to help us understand this ruling and where it leaves us is Jackie Prang, senior attorney and managing litigator with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome to Counterspin, Jackie Prang.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's look into this ruling from Brian Morris of the U.S. District Court in Montana. What does it say that's significant?
Well, there are a couple things in the ruling that are significant. And first off, what you mentioned earlier, I think, is the main point, which is that construction on the pipeline is blocked by this order. And the reason the court felt that there shouldn't be any construction is because the environmental review documents underlying the approval of the pipeline were flawed and need to be revisited by the administration.
Well, the judge lists a few things, essentially, that the Trump administration did wrong in their abrupt reversal of the Obama administration's ruling. What were some of the things that he suggested had been done inappropriately or ignored?
Part of this goes back to some of the history here, and it's important to remember that in 2015, the Obama administration denied the pipeline, rejected it because of its climate and other impacts. And when the Trump administration tried to reverse that decision and fast-track it, it didn't do what it was supposed to under the law. It relied on very old environmental review documents that were there since the Obama administration. These documents were prepared in 2014. And so it was using those documents many years later to support an approval of the pipeline when they had previously supported a denial of the pipeline. And so the judge ordered the government to go back and review changes that happened since 2014 that are really critical. For example, changes in the oil market. Since 2014, there's been a huge drop in oil prices, and that could affect whether this pipeline is viable and whether it will increase the rate of tar sands production in Canada. This pipeline is designed to bring dirty tar sands fuel to the United States from Canada. And one of the big areas of dispute is whether that would happen anyways and without the pipeline. And so oil prices are really critical to that decision. Some other things that the government needs to address is whether there will be cumulative effects with approvals of other pipelines on greenhouse gases. And the administration also ignored important information, new information about oil spills, including a big oil spill on another pipeline, the Keystone 1 pipeline, we call it, that TransCanada is currently operated. There was a large spill just last year that was not covered in the environmental review documents. And there's also one other different sort of claim that I think is really important and telling about how the Trump administration dealt with this approval. What the court said was, in deciding that this pipeline was in the national interest, the Trump administration had simply disregarded prior factual findings regarding climate change. So in 2015, the Obama administration said this pipeline is not in our national interest because of its effects on climate change and because it harms the U.S.'s leadership role on the issue. And then in 2017, the Trump administration reversed that finding without any sort of reasoned explanation. The court said that can't happen and sent it back on those grounds.
Well, the ruling is being framed everywhere as a setback for Trump. And it is, certainly on some level, but that seems to me to be helping him to dismiss the ruling as merely political. And it seems more important to talk about what the ruling means for the planet, for the environment, for the indigenous communities that that pipeline would go through, for the air and the water. I mean, this framing of it as a kind of Obama did it, Trump took it back, seems to be me to be missing the real core here.
Yes, that's right. And this is really an extremely large pipeline for a very dirty oil source. And I think that's important for people to understand. We're not just talking about any oil. We're talking about tar sands oil that is, in many cases, strip mined from the earth and one of the most carbon intensive fuels on the planet. Yes, it could have extremely detrimental impacts on local communities, including indigenous communities, and especially on water. This pipeline is going to cross many water bodies. So that's absolutely true. And I think it also speaks to a larger importance about how this administration deals with facts and deals with the facts of climate change. Here, the Trump administration wanted to just ignore that or sweep that under the rug. And the court is saying, no, that can't happen.
Well, I'm a little concerned about this idea that I'm seeing in some stories that, well, they need to go back and make a better case, or as I've seen it put in some places, they need to show their work. You know, they need to explain why they reversed this Obama rejection. But I mean, is there really a schema in which a tar sands pipeline can be shown to not contribute to greenhouse gases and endanger land and water? It almost sounds like if they could just hit on the right formula for selling it, that it would somehow make sense. I'm not sure I understand that.
I mean, no, these pipelines are, especially, and tar sands in particular, do have extremely important impacts on our climate. And so that is true that, you know, the ruling, I think it's important for people to understand that this was a huge win, and it's very important for the rule of law and for the importance of facts and truth. But at the same time, this is just one battle. This war is not over yet. And what's going to happen is there's another opportunity for the administration to consider this decision and consider the facts. What the ultimate outcome of that will be, I can't say yet. Maybe we have a clue based on past behavior. But the win is significant in that it does require adherence to the rule of law. But this project is not dead yet by any means. And I do think it's important for people to understand that, and to understand that the fight's going to continue.
Well, absolutely. Of course, being that it is a business, slowing it down can also have its own impact. But I guess I'm struck by news reports that are emphasizing construction's temporarily halted or delayed. And I know that that's literally true, but I'm concerned by this undertone of kind of inevitability, you know, not just of this pipeline, but basically of the U.S. just extracting every last bit of fossil fuel that's there, despite what we know about the impact on the climate. But then, you know, you turn to another page in the paper and you read about Wales, you know, or you read about Spain. It seems like other countries are showing us models to make Keep It In The Ground be what we're really doing to make it more than a slogan. It's not that it's impossible.
And I know it's hard in these times to be optimistic. You know, the most recent IPCC report was really hard to take. And obviously the administration's utter refusal to consider the reality of climate change is very difficult. But I think this is a glimmer of hope in that broader picture, in that at least parts of our government, including the judicial branch, are taking climate change seriously, and that there is some hope, and that it matters whether the government can just say, we totally are going to ignore all the facts, and that can't hold up in court. So I try to remain optimistic. I do know it's hard in these times, but I do think there is still hope.
Absolutely. And well, what else can you do? Well, let me just ask you finally, I know that the NRDC has been involved in this case along with Indigenous Environmental Network and the Center for Biological Diversity. There's a lot of work that goes into a case like this, and it isn't just lawyers. There's a whole lot of folks who are working on the Keystone case, just as on Dakota Access, and it's not just about defeating a particular pipeline, but groups are being formed and communities are being formed and folks are kind of finding their strength in a new way. I mean, even outside the law, there's a lot that's positive that's going on.
That's absolutely true. And this case and my participation in this case is just one small part. It's really the advocacy of so many people and groups over the years that have even gotten us to this point where if they hadn't been involved, this pipeline would have been built years ago. And so certainly, and there are many tools left in the tool basket. There's the Nebraska Supreme Court is currently considering the route through Nebraska. And so there are many different fronts on which the fight continues. This is just one of them. And I think that's absolutely true, that everyone has a different part to play.
We've been speaking with Jackie Prang, senior attorney and managing litigator with the Natural Resources Defense Council. You can find their work online at nrdc.org. Jackie Prang, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website. That's FAIR.org. The website is also the place to look into subscriptions to FAIR's newsletter Extra or to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
We still have a chance to save ourselves.
Before I introduce our next guest, let's try this. Yesterday, during a phone check, you talked to me about an Isaac Asimov science fiction novel and the possibility of a psychology of the future. What was that about?
Yeah, I was, of course, like so many of us, raised on science fiction. I loved it. And I think you'll find that most scientists today still secretly or unsecretly still love science fiction. But the great Isaac Asimov wrote several books called the Foundation series. And the crux and the center of this was that psychologists were in the future able to produce a quantitative way of understanding and predicting human behavior. And in so doing, they tried to produce a new empire that would forestall 10,000 years of chaos, or so the story went. And this was called psychohistory. I'm wondering if we are not through a totally different way approaching that, because I think what I'm hoping is that psychologists begin merging with biologists to understand the effect of stress molecules through time as a predictive aspect.
Listeners, did you guess our guest? Longtime Radio EcoShock listeners will remember several previous interviews with University of Washington Professor Peter Ward. We talked about the causes of past mass extinctions, about climate change in the deep past and the near future, about sea level rise, and even his theory that life may have suicidal tendencies. But now Peter is back with something completely different, as you've heard, and it is epigenetics, and it could change everything. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
And thank you for having me.
Well, look, you know, we are all busy people. We are probably bombarded with more information every day than our village ancestors received in a lifetime. Why should we make room in our brains for epigenetics?
Well, it's interesting. Science progresses in a very conservative fashion, as we know. And there were historians of science and philosophers of science who suggested that the way science proceeds, again, is very conservative, very conservative. And it's only through revolutionary change, called a paradigm change, that we see an entirely new type of understanding. For instance, Copernicus putting the Earth around the sun rather than vice versa, Einstein with relativity, quantum mechanics, there are any number of these, plate tectonics close to home. The idea that continents could move was heresy until the 1960s. Well, we're seeing something now that's very interesting. It's potentially, perhaps not on the order of those others, but potentially even more important. This is the understanding that the great long-dead biologist Jean Lamarck and his French colleagues in the 1780s, Lamarck has produced or did produce an idea about evolution called Lamarckism. It is and has been ridiculed ever since Darwin. Well, now scientists are understanding that some of the things that Lamarck proposed may actually be taking place. And the single most important is that things that happen to you in your life may actually change your genes in such a way that it affects the children that you will have.
So does it actually change the genes, or does it change the expression of those genes? I mean, genes offer you a selection of several different choices, and if you choose this, you get door number A, and if you choose that, you get door number B. Is that the way it's working?
Yeah, you're exactly correct. The genes themselves, the actual gene sequence that you pass on, that stays the same. And so this was what Darwin suggested even before he knew about genes. And it's always been a comfort, I think, to think that no matter how much you screw up your life, you are not going to change the family, the sum total of the genes that you pass on. But when I say change the genes, I mean that there are effects during our lives, great environmental changes, that add on tiny little freeloaders. The most common method for epigenetics is that a gene becomes methylated, a tiny little organic molecule, a carbon with a couple of hydrogens, is added on to the DNA molecule. It goes on like a little limpet or a little parasite. And it used to be thought that when we passed on sperm and eggs, that all of these markers, all these tiny freeloaders, were erased, and that none of the information, such information, was passed on. The new discoveries is that this is not true. And the most interesting and the scariest deal with the effects that huge amounts of environmental change can have on us, and not just on us, all animals, all plants, all microbes, and that these, in effect, the most dangerous for humans being violence and huge stressful situations, can affect our children for at least three generations.
Well, I heard you were bringing out a new book called Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding of Evolution's Past and Present. And I thought, what is Peter Ward doing in epigenetics? That's not really your field. How did you get going in that? And then I started thinking about our very first Radio EcoShock interview where you talked about exploring rocks off the coast of British Columbia, and you saw with your own eyes a layer that represented 10 million years with no sign of life, and then there's life again. And I'm wondering if that unexplainable shift is what tossed you into this new field to reconsider evolution.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a paleontologist is doing nothing but studying the change of animals through time in the fossil record. But what really has always been the greatest knock against current paleontology, and especially the evolutionary theory behind it, is that some species seem to occur, they change so quickly that it seems impossible that this could have happened anyway other than through some divine effect, that we're talking about intelligent design with some godlike being who orchestrates and produces, through magic, I guess, a new species. And there continues to be the anti-evolution push by those called creationists, and there's all kinds of creationists. And it seemed to be that it must be a better way. And what epigenetics is showing us is that there can be evolutionary change up to 1,000 times faster than can take place through normal Darwinian mechanisms. We remember the way that Darwin and all evolutionists subsequent to him have suggested is that evolution takes place through random, slow genetic mutations. Most of those mutations are really bad, deleterious. A few are good, and natural selection then favors those with these improved, if you will, I hate to use that word, but improved set of genes. In epigenetics, we have a way of producing much more variability much more quickly, way faster, and it removes the stigma of saying, oh my gosh, that species occurred way too quickly for natural processes. No, it didn't.
Well, that raises a crazy hope in me, Peter, because I feel like our present human brains are just not up to the job of climate change, that we are creating in all of our technologies things that we don't even know where they're going, whether it's artificial intelligence and all that. So there have been people who said, well, we just need to evolve into a new species. We'll awaken into something else. But of course, that would take much longer than we have. But maybe with epigenetics, we could actually change some way so we can survive who we are.
Well, you're exactly right. And really, the most important epigenetic process that is now used by humans is the manipulation of genes through something called a CRISPR Cas9 type of process. CRISPR-Cas9 is a set of proteins. You can inject it. And what it is, it's really a hunt and search program that hones in on one particular gene in a genome. You can go and destroy a particular gene, and then you can replace it with one that you want. Now, we know that this is taking place. It is like magic, but it's not. Chinese scientists used a CRISPR method to insert a different type of gene in dogs. This gene called for gigantic muscles. So they took the skinniest known dogs, whippets, put one gene change in, and they produce these enormously muscular dogs. They did it with beagles. They on purpose took these really sort of funny, happy-looking dogs and produced enormous military-grade dogs. And their statement was that these dogs could be useful as military weapons.
Watch out for attack whippets.
Well, I mean, this is the funny deal, but let's put this inside a Mastiff or a German Shepherd. And it isn't just the muscles. Let's put a gene in for longer teeth. Let's put a gene in that lets the dog live and work with much less need for food, much less need for water. It doesn't get as tired. We increase its size. CRISPR-Cas9 has all of these potentials. And, of course, the next step is, if you can do it in a dog, can you do it in a human? And the answer is yes.
Well, but couldn't we do something similar to help with the epidemic of obesity and diabetes and maybe even cancer? I mean, get some of the diseases looked after rather than military weapons.
Well, yes, and what you hope to see is that we remove some of the most horrendous of genetic diseases, these inherited maladies that are themselves quite often produced by one bad gene. The hope of CRISPR is that you can remove that gene. So the reason I bring this up is that CRISPR is a change in gene during the lifetime of an animal. That's a Lamarckian process. That's not Darwinian. That's Lamarck. That's epigenetics. And epigenetics at its most powerful as well as its most scary.
Well, let's go back a little bit in time. You look in your book at the example of the Black Plague in the 1300s, and who doesn't think about the Black Death? Well, I know that the French intellectual Michel Foucault saw the plague as the start of a prison society, but you call it an epigenetic event. Would you like to talk about that? How did it affect all following generations?
Well, we know, interestingly enough, that organisms that are pushed into highly stressful situations, such as starvation, such as disease, such as warfare, violence, produce an excess of stress molecules. We humans have a molecule called cortisol. It is the same molecule that was first evolved way back 500 billion years ago by the most primeval fish and modern-day lampreys, these awful sucking creatures, have it just as we have it. So we have a 500-million-year-old molecule, not improved in 500 million years, that is like a blunt hammer. The thing about this molecule is when we're stressed, eventually stress dissipates. And it does so because there are tiny little bits, tiny molecules within cells that are like tiny little enzyme destroyers. They chew up the stress molecule, knock off some atoms, and the stress molecule no longer produces the stress. But in some people, these changes reduce the number of stress reducers. And we have a gene called the MAO gene, sometimes called the violence gene, that in some people, if it is produced through violence, that the gene is there, but the gene is pushed into this extreme form by violent events, that can be passed on. And these people have stress molecules that never go away. After a while, when you have such long-term stress, you no longer react to it at all. And there has been correlation between this particular gene and homicides, violent crimes, a great deal of madness going on in Scandinavia. I mean, it's a very difficult subject to test now. If you go out and test your children and find they have this bad sort of gene, what are you going to do? So we're really seeing this whole new world. I go back to your first statement, could we make things better? Well, we know that human intelligence is not coded on any one gene. It's coded on hundreds and hundreds. I think the last I heard was 400. It's probably more than that. So one single gene change isn't going to do much for human intelligence. But who says you have to stop at one? These things, it has now been successfully shown that you can use the CRISPR-Cas9 method on a human embryo. And that embryo takes this new gene and then goes forward through time. And not only does the embryo and the subsequent human, they never let it get beyond a few days in age, but they could have, not only does the embryo keep it, but it passes on this new gene to all subsequent generations. Let's go back to the Black Death. We know that in times of high stress, a second aspect of stress does, it increases mutation rates. Mutation rates themselves, a Darwinian mechanism, if you can increase the rate of mutations, you push more rapidly evolution. During the Black Death, what could be more horrible than watching your loved ones die? We always think about the battlefield soldiers. We think about the people killed by the Black Death. When they're killed, however, their genes are not passed forward. Any future children, that's over with. But the survivors, we never think about the survivors. What stress it must have been to watch 4/5 of all of your children die. And how that would, I think, really stimulate evolutionary change in the survivors moving forward.
Well, I want to get back to that subject of how near-death experiences could affect our children and their children maybe even. But I'm also thinking, Peter, about what we talked about in the very beginning of this, how the future could affect the present. And I say that because lately I've seen more and more emails from people who are saying they're deeply worried about climate science and what emissions really mean for our future. They may not even want to have children. I'm wondering if there could exist a kind of pre-climatic stress syndrome, kind of like PTSD, but ahead of the event. Is it possible that even presumptions about the future could also have an epigenetic effect through the stress mechanism that you're describing?
Absolutely. I got myself in enormous trouble 2 years ago. Gizmodo, which is a website somewhere in the U.S., I guess, called a number of we evolutionists, and I was just a random name they came up with. They know I study evolution. And they asked me about the brand new dogs that the Chinese had done. And then they asked me, could super soldiers be produced? And I said, yes, absolutely. But then I went on to say that I believe that at least in the last 5 years, we in America, I don't know about you Canadians, but it's the globe is the globe. We Americans are exhibiting every bit of evidence of highly increased stress rates. For instance, if we could take a blood sample of every single American right now, today, and every single Canadian, what would the average stress level be by age, by gender, by sexual orientation, by race? Do we see a change then with how those stress levels were 5 years ago? And I think, yes. And what I said in that interview that got me in so much trouble that, in fact, my university president was contacted, the Board of Regents, demanding that I be fired. I said that since the election of Trump, the stress levels in the U.S. have gone up markedly, and that this itself may have a future revolutionary effect on Americans. Boy, they didn't like that at all. I went on later after I was just eviscerated online saying, well, look, if Hillary Clinton had been elected, there would be the same amount of stress. There's just something going on in our society that is ratcheting up stress. And in so doing, we are pushing forward human evolution.
Well, I can't argue with that. And in fact, I'm surprised that you didn't get threats of violence because there's so much violence going on. I think in particular in American society right now, there was another mass shooting today and there'll probably be another one tomorrow. So that's a pretty serious situation. Look, Otter, I want to cover some of the current epigenetic events, so to speak, that you talk about in your book. And here's one of them, and it's about toxins in the environment. I'm currently corresponding with a professor in New England who studies the re-release of lethal, long-lived chemicals like PCBs, and they're reappearing as European glaciers melt in a warming world and hurricanes like Florence can stir up environmental toxins. Talk to us about the role of that in epigenetics.
Yeah, this is a major interest to a number of people, and believe me, there are political consequences for faculty who even bring this up. Here in Washington State, there is a man that I co-dedicated the book to by the name of Skinner. He has been looking at the effect of agricultural chemicals on rats. If you want to study epigenetics, you want something that breeds quickly, and you're certainly not going to use humans, although I think we are already doing a gigantic human experiment. We'll get to that in a second. But he exposed rats to, I think the name of the chemical was vincozoline. This is something we use in fields that it doesn't kill weeds, but it ruins rust. It takes care of some of the really nasty growths on leaves that reduces overall crop yield. This stuff really affected rats. It produced second, third, and fourth generation rats that were not exposed to it. So you expose a mama or papa rat, they then have little ratlings, little pups, and those pups have had their genes methylated to the point that they exhibit really aberrant behavior. They showed a great deal of looked like a loss of mental acuity. I mean, this sounds sort of funny, but you can actually track rats' mental acuity through mazes. But they also showed that the rats showed a vastly reduced reproductive potential. The sperm that they produced in the young males were deformed, that there were any number of birth defects, and that these were directly related to their parents being exposed. This is epigenetics, an environmental change. The parents produce their offspring. The offspring have been affected by something that they never experienced.
Radio EcoShock.
From the University of Washington, our guest is Dr. Peter Ward. We're talking about his new book, Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding. This is Radio EcoShock, and I am Alex Smith. In 2006, Peter, I interviewed a Dr. Frederica Pereira from Columbia University, and she monitored what pregnant women in Harlem were breathing. They actually put on backpacks whenever they went out, and they had all sorts of measuring. And then they found, and this is very disturbing, that this micropollution was visibly changing parts of the DNA in their babies right in the womb, a kind of genetic expression. Now, that sounds to me like an example of epigenetics at work.
Well, it is. And in fact, the textbooks and all the research on epigenetics say that the most consequential time for any mammal is in the womb. That is the time that the embryo growing into a fetus is itself very susceptible to all kinds of epigenetic change that are brought into its environment through the mother. And so we've always known, gee, mothers shouldn't drink alcohol and on and on and on, but we have not understood the degree to which the environment the mother experiences has an effect. It's not just the physical environment, it's the mental environment. The degree of stress that a mother is going through itself can produce vast epigenetic changes in the fetus. And secondly, we always seem to give men a pass on this, saying, oh my gosh, yes, that mother, before she had children, she had all these effects in her life. She experienced violence. She experienced chemicals. But thank good, this never affects men. It's not true at all. Male sperm themselves will be burdened by these little epigenetic freeloaders when men experience nasty aspects. And some of the scariest of studies to me are dealing with men with violence against women. We always say that the children of the survivors of violence are themselves can be more violent simply because they witnessed the violence. But it really looks as if there is epigenetic effects in some of these, not all, but some of these, that produces a much higher chance that they will themselves be violent as well.
Wow. You also have a chapter on famine, and in my feeling, there was a little bit more famine in the 1960s than now. We've improved our distribution of food a bit, but right now in Yemen, there's up to 10 million people right on the edge of famine or experiencing it now, and there are various places in Africa, other places where people are pretty hungry. And we've been told poor nutrition can affect intelligence. What did you find about famine from the perspective of epigenetics?
Yes, well, the famine aspect is really one of the very first ways that the importance of epigenetics was discovered. And it goes back to World War II. A well-known aspect of the end of the war was that the Nazis tried to starve as many people in Holland as possible. And it was called the Dutch starvation, the Dutch winter starvation. This was from 1944 winter into 1945. The children coming from people who survived that famine were found often to have eating disorders. Many of them became very obese, but others, like Audrey Hepburn, they were not even, the women didn't even have to be pregnant during the famine. But if they experienced famine, they produced epigenetic changes that were passed on, leading to eating disorder and also mental disorders. The great famines of the 60s you talk about, the greatest single famine, we talked about Biafra, and we talked about Eastern Africa and Ethiopia, but it was China which experienced perhaps the most pervasive and populous famine. And this was, again, in the 60s, where Mao was trying to bring in new types of agriculture, but he was also moving as many peasants, agricultural peasants, into factories as he could. Food production lagged, and there were enormous famines. Now we are two generations after that, and still coming from that particular event, there are epigenetic and very sad human changes that have occurred.
I'm wondering, Peter, if we can understand epigenetics better using the analogy of genetic damage from radiation. Doctors have warned that a dose of radiation can go beyond cancer in the person receiving it to changes in birth for several succeeding generations after that. Aren't there similarities?
Yes. If the change is inherited, it's epigenetics by definition. So if you are blasting the DNA of some person and they have passed on some of these changes that are heritable, now quite often radiation can affect various aspects of DNA, and this might produce in that fetus changes which themselves are deleterious and that produce some really nasty effects, but these wouldn't be passed on. So you really have to distinguish between those effects which can produce these epigenetics versus those effects which simply destroy a genome, perhaps really change the coding in one gene that's necessary. But that can't be passed on.
Now, reading your article published in the journal Nautilus in August 2018, and I'll put links to that in my blog, listeners, your conclusions about epigenetic changes sound almost like a form of heritable post-traumatic stress disorder. For example, a near-death experience might change things in our bodies, as well as in our minds, that could even affect our children. And that's a pretty frightening possibility. Would you talk to us about that?
Well, sure. And again, the sad aspect is last night in America, we had another shooter. We had a soldier that definitely, well, I don't know, I can't say this, but this is a soldier who served multiple tours in combat zones, as I understand, and that he just, I guess what we say, he went crazy and shot up and killed many innocent people. There can be nothing, I think, more traumatic and more prone to produce epigenetic change than surviving combat. Being in combat and seeing the effects of modern weaponry has to be one of the most horrific things in the world. What happens in a scary sense is when soldiers come back, so many of them are damaged. But what we've never understood is that they're not only damaged, but they may be having permanent changes, they have these epigenetic changes that can then be passed on. One of the striking things that I did and try to put in the book, and I'm getting eviscerated for this on Amazon, but I've never gotten such poor ratings in my life, but I think I'm hitting really close to home. If you look at World War I and start with the FBI crime statistics, well, the FBI was barely in, I don't even think it was present in 1918. But indeed, there were statistics about murder rates and violence in America moving on to the time the FBI was formed. You can see that the murder rate, the violence rate, goes in a series of peaks and valleys. And these are about one generation in length. There's about a 20 to 25 to 28 year cycle of these high peaks. So World War I gives rise in one generation to World War II, which gives rise in one generation to Vietnam. And then we move into the conflicts in Saddam country. And now, according at least to the figures that I produce, and again, I just got these off FBI websites, that we're moving up to peak violence, that the last two or three years, every single year, has seen more of these shooting events. And according to my figures, this will peak out in 2020 and then descend.
Wow. Okay. So let's picture more extreme events driven by climate change, you know, the fires, the floods, the heat, and the stress that that produces. I guess it would take a science fiction writer to try and think about what changes that may produce in the next generation, in the kids of the people who go through those climate-induced stresses.
Oh, it's going to be enormous. We already see that what climate events do, first of all, if you survive, for instance, a major hurricane, but then it's afterwards where quite often, especially if you're in what we used to call third world countries where food supply is cut off, electricity is cut off, that you are dealing with actual day-to-day survival. Stress levels from that surely must activate some of these epigenetic events. starvation from climate change. Heat, I mean, the absolute heat stress that is being produced, heat already, we know, has huge effects on organisms. So we're looking, climate change itself is going to be a major driver of human evolution, I believe, over the next years. And let's go back to one that really, I think, hasn't gotten enough press. Male sperm levels over the last 40 years have dropped by about 50%. We're looking at least in Americans, and North America, no, it's just all North Americans, Canadians too, sperm counts are way, way down. They are not down in Africa nor in South America. So the authors of this, and it was a long, long study with thousands of data, so this is not due to experimental error in any sense. They said it's either based on climate change or it's the chemicals, that we are wallowing in chemicals in North America. I suspect it's the latter. This is also tied up to the fact that the number of insects that we find in North America has dropped markedly. I mean, I used to drive across the country or anywhere in summer, your windshield is totally splattered. But now multiple studies on multiple continents have said that the biomass of insects is less than half or even less than that in many places. We are losing insects. It could be the climate change, but I think it's a combination of climate change and the chemicals in the environment.
Yeah, I remember covering on this show a study of nature areas in Germany where people have been out counting insects meticulously for several decades, and there's no question that the life that they found there had crashed. And it's not something we all notice in our day-to-day life, especially if we live in a city, but it sure is important to the continuing existence of Earth and life on Earth anyway.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
From the University of Washington, we are talking with Peter Ward. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. And Peter's new book is Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding of Evolution's Past and Present. Well, ever since Jean-Baptiste Lamarck first proposed inheritance of acquired characteristics in the 1700s, that vision, Peter, as you said, has been systematically squashed by scientists who champion Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. And I know that's continuing. You've talked about some of the criticism of your book. Why do you think people react so strongly to a suggestion that there's something other than Darwin?
You know, that's a really great question. And it is, the evolutionists really don't like this. There are many who say that we're not challenging Darwinism at all. We're adding on the great paradigm of evolutionary change, biological evolution. This is simply more information about it. I mean, it's equivalent to the discovery of genetics, the discovery of what DNA is, the discovery that there are large areas of genomes that we used to think had no purpose at all, and now we're finding, in fact, they do. So we're simply adding in new information. But I think we began this conversation with my statement that science and scientists are really conservative. I mean, really conservative. The fact that any major paradigm change, there are people who study epigenetics who say, oh, no, no, we're going to totally topple evolutionary theory and a whole new theory will be built. It's not that extreme. This is adding on just a new layer of understanding. I mean, the processes that Darwin talked about do take place. Natural selection does take place. But we now know that there can be rapid changes when the environment is critical. If you really want to look at how fast this can take place and a really down-home suggestion, turns out that the fastest evolving creatures we know with vertebrates are chickens, followed by dogs. We think of it just selective breeding, but there's surely epigenetics taking place too. Lamarck said that what happens is first the environment changes, but here's then in part two, he differs from Darwin. Then he says there are behavioral change in response to the environmental change. New behavior causes organisms to act in different ways. Natural selection can begin working in entirely different ways. And at that point, you start seeing different types of morphologies that that are favored that may not have been favored in the past, and you get this big flush of all kinds of different types of morphology. After the mass extinctions, we saw mammals occur in huge numbers. But those huge numbers of mammals didn't take place while the dinosaurs were there. And it's certainly the disappearance of dinosaurs opened up new ability for mammals. But the rate at which they appeared has always been the mystery. They could have and should have and would have been produced through epigenetics. Let's go back to chickens. Chickens came from a tiny little ground bird in Borneo, I believe. Looks just like a chicken, except it's tiny, about robin size. And it is, of course, a nice little meal for all the predators. So this tiny little bird spends most of its life, A, looking for food, B, trying not to get eaten. Well, what happens when you domesticate a chicken or any animal? You put it in a cage so the predators can't get it. It no longer has the worry of being eaten. Secondly, we feed domestic animals. It no longer has to spend most of its time looking for food, and C, we give it mates. It no longer has to go through the time-consuming aspects of mating. Well, these three things, all good things for the chicken, are also certainly major environmental change. Environmental change doesn't have to be disaster. It can also be good things. It's still a major environmental change. And from that, out of that, came this explosion of kinds based on the chicken body plan. But we know that their intelligence is different, their behaviors are different, their size is different, lots of different colors, lots of different kinds. This is for chickens, it's for dogs, it's for domestic cats. And I just wonder, too, if we humans haven't gone through our own domestication process.
I'll bet we have. I just read about a Swedish study where they took chickens and basically they didn't torture them, but they made them under stress. They kept changing the lighting and changing their food regimen and such. And then they ran them through a maze and they found that they were unable to do the maze as well as other chickens. And then they checked that their chicks that were raised separately from them, they didn't learn from their parents. And those chicks also had difficulty with the maze compared to chicks that had not had stressed out parents. So yeah, even chickens are examples of epigenetics.
That's a classical case. Yep.
I'd like to talk about something a little bit different just for a minute, and then we'll get back to your book. And that is your first book, or your earlier book, let's say, the 2007 Under a Green Sky. You suggested a past mass extinction could have been caused by a switch from oxygen-breathing sea life to sulfate-eating bacteria instead. And I've just talked with Professor Uli Wortmann from the University of Toronto about a study published in August of 2018 that said, yeah, this is happening in the ocean, that we're seeing more sulfate-eating bacteria and the deoxygenation of the ocean is starting to happen. Do you still think that ocean warming could trigger an existential risk somewhere down the line?
Oh, absolutely. And the other, look, every bit of information we have about the temperature rise going on the planet shows that every one of these IPCC estimates have been too conservative. Once again, the same old story, scientists are conservative. And so they put out these estimates, and then lo and behold, a decade goes by, and we see that the numbers don't support it at all. We're getting warmer way faster than has been predicted in some of the worst-case scenarios. So we're seeing now that as you get warmer, this is affecting ocean bottoms. The one that scared me the most was off the west coast of California, where very large oceanic anoxic zones, these are areas on the bottom where there's no oxygen at all. These have been increasing in size and appearing in the California borderlands. This isn't just shallow water, and we see this all the time in the Gulf of Mexico, but these are deep water basins. And this is for the first time now we're seeing exactly the mechanism that brought about eventually most of the mass extinctions. We are moving along that pathway. How far do we go? Don't know. I mean, if we stop the rate of global warming right now, the oceans are still going to rise by 3 feet. But how much of the ice caps also gets melted? You know, what is the latent heat that we have already increased? How far do the ice caps melt? That's really the determining question for so much of human future history.
And in your later book, The Medea Hypothesis, you oppose James Lovelock's idea of life organizing to support life that's been dubbed Gaia. In fact, your overview of what we know of life's crazy ride on this planet, based on your paleontological studies, suggests a tendency towards mass suicide. Have you changed your mind or found any reason to be more cheerful about our future?
I think just taking the conversation we've just had, I think that answers that. No, we I think are looking at a very harsh future. I still have hope. I think we have enormous tools. The degree to which we are producing AI, artificial intelligence, as tools is certainly going to help in many respects. Most people also say you have to be pretty careful of AI. But one of the aspects that really shocked me the most in my earlier days when I suggested the rare earth hypothesis that intelligent life in the universe might be very rare, I debated over and over with people from SETI and Seth Shostak. They're tremendously literate and public speaking frontman. Told me once that he expects that they will find aliens, but any aliens we find are not going to be biological. They will already be the changeover from biology to artificial, that we'll be looking at robots or looking at AI of some sort, that the eventual change from species such as us is a move upward. I've been reading a series of new science fiction books by actually a Canadian writer where that is discussed as part of the plot mechanism. But it is a case where we do have to look at what is the future in terms of our technology, and at what point can we get to the point where we can at least stop this rapid rise, because hot worlds are not anything we evolved in. We evolved in ice and snow. Now we're going to be seeing a planet where, at least if we continue on the rate we're going, that there's going to be no ice and no snow anywhere on this planet.
Getting back to your new book on epigenetics, with that Darwinian mindset, we all assume that our actions might affect our children psychologically if they see us drinking or if they see us fighting, as you said, but not really change them physically. But now, if epigenetics is true, then our personal responsibility changes in a super way. I mean, we really are going to have an effect on our kids and maybe even on their kids.
Yes, absolutely. And this is one of the implications that I try to write about in the book, is that one of the possibilities of this is a possibility of a new Puritan age. Let's say you have a set of grandparents, or they want to be grandparents. And it's always been focused on the mother, of course, that it's the mother who, if she drinks during pregnancy or smokes. But now we know that some of the really nasty changes can take place by our behaviors when women are not pregnant, and in men as well. We're seeing the use of drugs in Southeast Asia, the use of a drug called betel nut, which is chewed by probably, I don't know, a billion people. The parents chew this, it affects them epigenetically, and it produces a great deal of mental problems, especially attention deficit in children. This is now known. What is marijuana doing to us? I know Canada just got this forward. What does smoking do to us?
Only good things, Peter. Only good things.
Well, you're right in that we do have to understand that our entire lifetime behavior is going to affect, if we have children, it's going to affect them.
Yeah.
And the two studies that spooked me is that they took rats again, and they removed the baby rats from the mother. They allowed no contact with the mother. They fed them artificially. And for the next two generations, those rats, which had no contact, physical contact with their mother, showed a great deal of aberrant and violent behavior. Secondly, one of the classic studies in epigenetics is they took a rat, they put a nice smell, what we think it was cherry blossoms. So they had perfume that smelled like cherry blossoms. They let the rat smell the cherry blossoms, and then they shocked the holy hell out of it with electricity. Nice. So every time that rat smelled cherry blossoms, it scared it. Its generations, the next two generations, having never encountered this, when they were given the cherry blossom smell, they were scared out of their minds. Epigenetics.
But one of your critics did raise a point that these epigenetic changes may not be stable. I mean, what if they are short-lived, just lasting one or two generations, and then everything reverts back?
Well, that's true. And one or two generations, and they do revert back. But that's saying that the effects that are producing them in the one or two generations has stopped. Are we going to stop climate change? Are we going to stop famine in the next generation or two? So at least in terms of humans, I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but I think the big changes affecting this evolutionarily, they're not going to go away within one or two generations. And so you do it over and over.
One final question. Is the average reader without any scientific training going to be able to read your new book?
Yeah, I've just stayed away from the really – I actually read many books on epigenetics, and I've got a PhD. I studied in a biology department. I couldn't understand half of them. So what I try to do is make this as much about fossils and the fossil record and then human history. The chapter about what epigenetics is short. If people want the real molecular and the equations, I refer them, because actually I did – the hardest part of this book was every time there's a statement, I put a footnote there. And so the note sections are 50 pages long. I don't know. It's huge. But I want to make sure that when I make a statement that it can be backed up. And a lot of those are the technical literature. What I've tried to do is make a cogent, understandable exhibition. It's not a long book. It's only 70,000 words, but at least it's a statement about how this could affect evolution, but mostly it's a statement about how it can affect us.
We have been speaking with Professor Peter Ward from the University of Washington. His latest book is Lamarck's Revenge, How Epigenetics is Revolutionizing Our Understanding of Evolution's Past and Present. I will put links to Peter, his book, and this conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, so look for that. It's published every Wednesday online. And Peter, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, no matter how gloomy the subject.
But it's not. I mean, the other good news is, once again, epigenetics holds promise to make life better for many of us and for many of our animals, for better food. There's the possibility we can increase food, we can affect the changes that climate change is going to do to us. So I tend to be on the sunny side, that I think the benefits can be better than the downsides.
Peter Ward on the sunny side. I'm not sure I'm ready. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In our interview, Peter Ward talks about the Dutch hunger winter. It was the first well-documented case of epigenetics. I'm going to read you a few lightly edited paragraphs from the Wikipedia entry on the heritable health impacts of the Dutch famine of 1944-45. Quote, the Dutch famine of 1944-45 was a rare case of a famine which took place in a modern, developed, and literate country, albeit one suffering under the privations of occupation and war. The well-documented experience has helped scientists to measure the effects of famine on human health. The Dutch famine birth cohort studied, carried out by health scientists in Amsterdam and Britain, found that the children of pregnant women exposed to famine were more susceptible to diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and other health problems. The discovery of the cause of celiac disease may also be partly attributed to the Dutch famine. With wheat in very short supply, there was an improvement at a children's ward of celiac patients. Audrey Hepburn spent her childhood in the Netherlands during the famine, and despite her later wealth, she had lifelong negative medical repercussions. Some studies have suggested that epigenetic damage caused by the famine has increased morbidity in the grandchildren of hunger winter survivors. End quote. That's just the beginning. There has been a great deal of research since, and Peter Ward plowed through it all, summarizing and documenting his sources. In April 2010, I recorded a public event in Vancouver with four experts called Epigenetics, Genes Developed Through the Generations, How Experience Modifies Our Genes. You can get a lot out of that, and I will put a link to the audio in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now, I have a short speech you need to hear. Craven politicians all over the world deny or ignore the developing tragedy of wrecking the climate. But in October, Canadian Green Party leader Elizabeth May spoke the hard truth to the Canadian Parliament. Here it is.
I want to begin by quoting some words, Mr. Speaker. Quote, humanity is conducting an unintended, uncontrolled, globally pervasive experiment whose ultimate consequences could be second only to global nuclear war. Close quote. Those words, Mr. Speaker, were the opening sentence of the consensus scientific report from the Toronto Conference in June 1988, when this government, this country, was in the lead on climate change, working with the World Meteorological Organization, the United Nations Environment Program. The warnings from science were clear then. They remain crystal clear now. That was in 1988. I've had a ringside seat, Mr. Speaker, to decades within which we could have arrested climate change before our glaciers were melting, before we were losing the Arctic, before our forests were on fire, before we saw drought and climate refugees and tornadoes in Ottawa. We had a chance in the 1990s, and we blew it. We had a chance in the first decade of this century, and every time there's been a warning from scientists, the alarm bell rings, and society hits the snooze button. I'm increasingly drawn to the conclusion that our biggest problem is the short-term mindset that preoccupies political parties, not just in Canada, but around the world. Where's the bravery? Where's the courage? There are all those people surrounding every politician saying, well, you can't win an election telling the public the truth. You can't tell people that they're going to have to stop using an internal combustion engine, leave fossil fuels on the ground. You want to tell them that? Well, that's not going to be politically popular. But if we're grown-ups in this place, if we face the science clear-eyed with a serious intent that says, all right, this is one report where we can't afford to hit the snooze button, because this time the scientists are telling us 1.5 degrees is far more dangerous than we thought it was. Reminds me of what Al Gore once said, that if we let the climate crisis continue apace, it would feel like a nature walk through the Book of Revelation. Well, we've allowed greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere to increase to such an extent that we have already changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. We can't change it back. We are leaving that hospitable period within which human civilization took root. We got up and started walking on two legs and then became the dominant force on the planet. And in a geologically and planetary lifespan, in a blink of an eye, humanity is the dominant force on this planet. We are entering the Anthropocene, where what we do has a bigger effect than anything else on life on Earth. And in the Anthropocene, now we are being told, you, Homo sapiens, the clever species, the smart ones, you have at most 10 to 12 years maybe to ensure that you stop greenhouse gas emissions rapidly, you ramp up what we can do with sequestration through protecting every forest and replanting as many as possible, and we're going to have to do some things besides that too. If we want to ensure we hold global average temperature increase to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above what it was before the Industrial Revolution. And parts of this report could have been much worse. We know from those who were in the IPCC negotiation, and bear in mind, this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Yes, it's composed of scientists, but they're appointed by government, and this is a negotiated document. And pressure from the United States and Saudi Arabia took out the parts of the report that would have warned us, oh yes, if you miss 1.5, it's bad. That's in the report. If you hit 2, it's much more dangerous. They took out the part about runaway global warming. We don't know when we'll hit a tipping point in which it becomes irreversible self-acceleration, where the ultimate consequences are not brace yourself for bad weather, but brace yourself for millions of species going extinct. And even if humanity can hang on, can we imagine hanging on to human civilization in a 4-degree, 5-degree, 6-degree, 7-degree world? The answer is no. So we have one chance only, within which all the nations on Earth agree that we met what we said in Paris. We must hold global average temperature increase to no more than 1.5 degrees. And in this, the IPCC special report contains good news. because it says you can do it. It says there are no physical, geological, geochemical, there are no conditions of planetary existence, technical or economic, that will prevent us from achieving the goal of protecting our children's future. Not future generations in the hypothetical, the children here, now, the grandchildren I tuck into bed at night, those children, not hypothetical children. All of us know those children. They are our children. We have one chance to ensure that in their natural lifespans, they enjoy a hospitable biosphere that has sustained humanity since we first got up and walked on two legs. So the issue is not to debate tonight Canada's current carbon plan, Canada's current climate plan. This is not a status quo debate. And we shouldn't be scoring political points because one party did this and another party did that. We should be here as humanity, human beings, elected people for our constituencies who know full well that if we don't change what we're doing as a species, we will face an unthinkable world. And the good news is we still have a chance to save ourselves. I increasingly, Mr. Speaker, am drawn to thinking about the 5 days in May 1940 when Winston Churchill was surrounded by people, the Lord Halifaxes and Chamberlains, who said, well, face facts. We can't defend this island. The Nazis are invading. Our entire army is now stranded at Dunkirk, 300,000 men, and you can't get them off. There's no way. So face facts and surrender. This is the moment when real political leadership steps up. This is where we need our prime minister to go to or to dispatch the Minister of Environment to the negotiations in Poland saying, we're stepping up. We're going to rescue everybody. We're going to be the heroes in our own story. We're going to adopt what the IPCC says we must do and 45% reductions by 2030. Churchill, of course, surrounded by naysayers, thought up a miracle, one that's clearly undoable. How many civilian boats are there in Dover? Well, we could get those civilians to cross the English Channel and rescue over 300,000 men. Really? It's hardly plausible. But in this time and in this age, we need to face facts just as squarely, and we need to say to Canadians, we've got hope. Do not despair. Do not think it's too late. Don't turn away from the IPCC reports. Don't be afraid because we can't breathe in British Columbia in the summer from forest fires. Don't give up. We rally. We marshal every small town, every big city, every Canadian group, Rotary clubs, church groups, and we tell those naysayers who think that climate change is about a cash grab that they are in the way of our future and they must get out of the way. But we also sadly must say to our own Minister of Environment, it's not true that we can't change our target for 5 years. The Paris Agreement says clearly any country can replace its own target any time. And the IPCC report has said to us as a country that our target is approximately 50% too little. We need to do twice as much. I know that's hard, but to save the lives of our children, what wouldn't we do? Why won't we rally round the call that we go to COP24 and say, we're not going to wait 5 years. It's an unthinkable thing what the minister said to us. She said we're going to wait till 2023. Read between the lines. That's what she just said. We must go to the next climate negotiation as leaders in the world with the target the scientists have told us we must have, and then we must stand up and challenge the others. Where's your target? Where's your goal? Because we are not prepared to tell our children we are a failed species. We are not going to do that because we are responsible human beings. We are Canadian parliamentarians, and we can together achieve the pathway that's been put before us by the world scientists. Time is not on our side. History may not be on our side. But by God, we better be on our own side. We better grab this chance and make it real. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
That was Canadian Green Party leader Elizabeth May speaking to Parliament in October 2018. We could only wish all our politicians could be so brave, or at least that they will hear her and turn towards climate action. Elizabeth led the Canadian Sierra Club for many years before becoming elected. She attended major climate conferences for decades. She has not given up and still says we have a slim chance to save ourselves, and we must. Please tell others about this program and cross-post it to your social media. These voices need to be heard. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and for caring about our world.
Phil, I have to ask you about a piece in today's Globe and Mail, co-written by Judy Reaver and Jeffrey York, who has been following the Rhonda story, and of course she's one of the experts on this issue. So last a week or so, it appeared that the smoking gun had been identified, and this week, all of a sudden, the French prosecutors find the whole thing very murky and don't have any evidence. And so, and of course, the foreign minister of Rwanda, a country that officially got rid of the French language, is now the leader of the Francophonie. So, is there a link to be drawn between all of this?
Well, I guess hypocrites are always linked. These guys, I would say, you know, people ought to really learn from this that there's nothing at the end of the day but politics. You know, isn't it a proverb in our culture to say, and people learn to say it. How's that thing going? You know, with the soccer clip, it's all politics. You know,
yes.
How about they? Did you find a new priest yet, or are they still? It's all politics, and it is. The French are. Mr. Macron is a total hypocrite. He has, of course, sold the lives of the French. True. The only reason France is involved in this discussion is the plane belonged to France, and it had been kind of leased or given as a for the use of the president of Rwanda, because at that time, President Mitterrand, people probably forgotten his name, but Mitterrand was a major party figure, a socialist party figure, and he was a bit of he was something of a French nationalist. There was French policy in Central Africa, where they carried a lot of weight. And so they were friendly to the government of Rwanda. And it was French insistence that the Arusha Accords be struck. They were very much in favor of a peace arrangement. They thought that their allies and friends would probably do well in a multi-party system, broadly democratic, and but that didn't pan out because the Arusha Accord was murdered on April the 6th, 1994. Paul Kagame and his friends decided to murder two presidents, Ntaryamira of Burundi, Hutu, Habyarimana Mana of Rwanda, Hutu. And the Globe and Mail gets it wrong in one important respect today, in my opinion. That they say that this was going to be it become the excuse, they said, for the RPF to Paul Kagame, which was at that time in contesting for power. He had an army, but it was at peace. They had the Arusha Accord, and they were supposed to have a new government formed in which the RPF would participate. However, they took the opportunity to assassinate Habyarimana. And Claude makes it out as though they use the phrase, it was an excuse to intervene because of the subsequent violence, because violence broke out in Rwanda with intercommunal violence amongst people. And so Claude says that that's why they did it. No, in my opinion, that isn't why they did it. They did it in order to decapitate the government of Rwanda. They murdered the president and major important people in his staff, but they meant they murdered the head of the Rwandan army, General Sabimana. So you get the president and you get the head of the army. And then on April the 7th and 8th, you have the help of General Dallaire and others who said to the surviving members of the government, we don't recognize you. We don't think you... This matter has to be sorted out. So you're a legitimate government on April the 6th, 1994. On the morning of the 7th and the following days, 8, 9, 10, you're told, we're not formally recognizing you. Well, I mean, you want to talk about a way to create havoc? That was done, and that was the UN, that was UNAMIR did that, and that was Kofi Annan, and that was all the way back up the line. They set the stage so that the government side, the army, lost its legitimacy when their head of their army and their president was killed. As for the business about the missile, I think it's a fool's errand in a way. I know Christopher Black, a lawyer, we've had him on the show, has done excellent work on this. And I know he has pointed out, and it's wise to underline it, is that this is not news. This is hot news about the missiles coming from Uganda. That's known. This has never been a dispute. And this is an article. And I, by the way, I appreciate Judy Reaver's work. Terrific work. Her book is, I hope everybody gets a copy of the book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. That phrase, praise of blood, she means that Western powers were congratulating Kagame on using force and causing bloodshed in praise of blood caused by him. But by the way, it wasn't him, of course. He knew he had the blessing of U.S. and Britain and France, not of Mitterrand, but he knew he could get away with it. And so they, Chris Black is right to point out, and others have pointed it out, that we knew this in 1996-97, because the United Nations, under Louise Arbour, who was going to set up the prosecution of the, at the International Criminal Court Tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, she had investigators, Mr. Hourigan, who was on the Taylor Report, and we have his interviews, so we did at least three or four with him. They were aware that the missiles had come from Uganda, as this thing of the numbers, identification, that was all confirmed. You know what they're doing today? The French government is saying, it's not that they don't have evidence. They say we don't have sufficient evidence, which is politics for we want to get along with Kagame. Just to give you a, you know, specific political, legal, pardon me, legal language, it's politics. They say they... The evidence is not sufficient. Actually, the evidence is basically overwhelming, but because France wants to play make nice with Kagame, this is what you have. I think that, Mr. Renschens is the guy they quote. I've met Mr. Renschens, and I worked, as people know, on the tribunal for Charles Roach and for Ramsey Clark. And with Chris Black and Defend Dixon and John Philpott, others, we worked on these things. I can tell you that Philip Renschens originally accused Colonel Bagasora of being behind this missile business to kill the president. He changed his point of view. But anybody who has studied it closely, you know, you say, well, actually, you know, maybe it'll go forward, maybe it won't. But you notice the only reason this we're talking about it is that French citizens, white people, were killed in the plane. Nobody else wanted to look into it. The Rwandan government didn't want it to be talked about. Louise Arbour made the decision not to have it talked about at the criminal tribunal because she was told by her investigators the RPF shot the plane. So they took the murder of the two presidents has never even been looked into since at all. The French are only interested because they lost three of their nationals. They have a problem of how do you, as a French leader, face the French people and say, somebody murdered these people, shot down our plane, and they're not going to pay for it. How come? So Macron has that little political problem fighting him. But otherwise, no one wants to know the truth. The government of Burundi would like to know. One last note on this. It shows a disrespect for Africa. The president of Kenya, Moi, he said when the assassination happened and everybody said, oh my goodness, and now we've had this conflagration, we have to have a criminal tribunal. President Moi of Kenya said, it must, at the top of the list of things to be done by any international investigation, is determine who murdered President Ntaryamira of Burundi and President Habyarimana of Rwanda. And the whole world ignored him. But, you know, Kenya is a major African country. But it only became interesting and had legs, as they say, because the French were involved and they lost some nationals. And so they kept it going. Moi himself went through turbulence and they put him aside. But the people who supported Moi are doing rather well these days, I'm happy to report. And so there we are. Anyway, that's...
Well, okay, Phil, on that note, I want to thank you for being a remote guest on your own show. So.
I really like it.
Yeah,
and well, thank you, Phil and Febby. You guys did great work.
The
energy is just rich in good personnel.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen, who discusses President Trump's firing of U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the mobilization of people across the U.S. to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia collusion investigation. Norman Solomon, co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org, who argues that the incoming Democratic Party majority in the House of Representatives should govern as progressives. And Jared Margolis of the Center for Biological Diversity, who talks about a federal judge's ruling that blocks construction of the Keystone XL pipeline as he ordered a supplemental environmental impact statement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amid international calls for a ceasefire, Saudi Arabia-led forces in Yemen have launched a new offensive in the port city of Hodeidah. Pro-government militias backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are attempting to push out Houthi rebels by the end of the year, when United Nations-backed peace talks begin. Since the Saudi coalition launched attacks in Yemen in 2015, the coalition imposed a blockade of Hodeidah, Yemen's main port city, which has led to famine and a deadly outbreak of cholera. A spokesperson for Save the Children maintains that the hunger crisis in Yemen shows no signs of fading as long as the fighting persists. In late October, U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis urged the Saudis to end their three-year proxy war in Yemen and join U.N. peace talks. In recent days, the Pentagon announced that it will halt all U.S. refueling of Saudi military aircraft in Yemen. U.N. human rights monitors have accused Saudi-led forces of committing multiple war crimes in Yemen. Humanitarian groups have also condemned Houthi rebels for occupying hospitals and putting civilian lives at risk of new Saudi airstrikes. Through the three-year war, an estimated 56,000 Yemenis have been killed and left 14 million people on the brink of starvation. In late October, the nation of Sri Lanka fell into a constitutional crisis when President Maithripala Sirisena fired Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe and replaced him with former authoritarian President Mahinda Rajapaksa, accused of human rights abuses and corruption. The deposed Prime Minister has refused to leave office and received support from members of parliament, triggering a major political crisis. Wickremesinghe is an advocate of closer ties with India and Japan, while President Sirisena has the backing of China. Amid the dueling prime ministers, President Sirisena dissolved parliament and called for new elections in early January. 3 years ago, President Sirisena and deposed Prime Minister Wickremesinghe were united in ousting Rajapaksa, who used brutal military tactics to defeat the Tamil Tiger rebels in a decades-long civil war. The new president and prime minister pledged to enact economic reforms, crack down on corruption, and initiate a war crimes investigation. Relations soured as Rajapaksa reclaimed the support of the nation's nationalist Buddhist majority. Tensions are rising as the country's Tamil and Muslim minorities fear that Rajapaksa will roll back freedoms and democratic gains made under Wickremesinghe in recent years. 7 major grocery chains employing over 125,000 workers have filed for bankruptcy for the last 3 years. The media has blamed disruptors, such as low-cost competitors like Walmart and Whole Foods, now owned by Amazon. But the American Prospect asserts that the real culprits in the industry are private equity owners who are behind all 7 bankruptcies. In the process, investors extracted tens of millions of dollars from chains like A&P, Pathmark, Winn-Dixie, and Fairway. Supermarket workers, by far one of the most unionized retail sectors, has lost ground. Among the 1.3 million members of the United Food and Commercial Workers, 60% work in food chains, while 15% work in meatpacking and food processing. The leveraged buyout of Southeastern Grocers, which owns Winn-Dixie and other food stores, is a classic example of how private equity's quest for quick profits drives retail chains out of business. Lone Star Funds bought the Bilo chain in a 2005 buyout and took the company private. It ran the company into bankruptcy by 2009 and emerged from Chapter 11 in 2010. It then unsuccessfully tried to sell the chain. Between 2011 and 2013, it paid itself and its investors $839 million in dividends, money that could have been used to make stores more competitive. The multiple abuses by private equity firms exist only because of loopholes in the law. Public policies can reduce incentives for the type of financial engineering that drove these grocery chains into bankruptcy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
After months of complaining about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision to recuse himself from overseeing Robert Mueller's investigation into allegations of Trump campaign collusion with the Russians, President Trump fired his one-time ally just 2 days after the midterm election, where the GOP lost control of the House of Representatives. Trump then bypassed the normal protocol for succession by appointing Sessions' Chief of Staff Matthew Whitaker as acting Attorney General, who will now oversee the Mueller probe. Legal observers in the state of Maryland have challenged the constitutionality of installing Whitaker as the nation's chief law enforcement officer without Senate confirmation, and point to his public criticism of the Mueller investigation, which included his advocacy of defunding the special counsel's budget and limiting the scope of the inquiry. In response to Sessions' firing, a broad coalition of groups launched 1,000 rallies nationwide on November 8th, calling for the Mueller investigation to be protected. For many months, these groups had been planning a rapid response to any threats that jeopardized the Mueller probe. Your reporter spoke with Lisa Gilbert, Vice President of Legislative Affairs with Public Citizen, who emceed the recent Nobody is Above the Law protest in Washington, D.C. Here she discusses Trump's firing of Attorney General Sessions, conflicts of interest, questionable ethics surrounding Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker, and threats to derail the Mueller investigation.
You know, we are very concerned that the removal of Sessions happened so quickly and the person that was put in is so unqualified, potentially unconstitutionally appointed, and clearly biased. You know, on that last point, he is the only potential candidate that Trump could have found who was within the DOJ, who was so clearly already out there with a blueprint for how to undermine the Mueller investigation. In some ways, he was interviewing for his job at the DOJ by writing about his plan to defund the investigation and to rein it in CNN or in the Wall Street Journal, speaking about it on television. So there's no question that Trump knew his pre-existing perspectives on the damage that the Mueller probe was doing to Trump and his family. That bias is very concerning, the fact that he shouldn't even been put in at all because the deputy AG is still there, and that's the line of succession. Rod Rosenstein should have become AG. So there are real constitutional questions. And then above all, the sort of ongoing just corruption allegations that we've seen about this man, you know, that is what makes him unqualified, the wrongdoing he's done in the past. So for all these reasons, you know, we triggered a rapid response network around the country because we thought that this was just unacceptable. So we were, you know, of course, concerned that we were asking activists to turn out right after an election season where so many of them had done so much and fought so hard for their preferred candidates and done GOTV for months. So we have a host of exhausted people, and we're going to ask them to turn out and organize rallies around the country. It was certainly a questionable prospect, but What we proved is that the American public really gets that it's not okay to violate the rule of law. And we were overwhelmed and thrilled at the outcome that we received. 1,000 rallies in every state, 100,000 people turning out. And people just showed that this is something that matters to them, and they're not going to take attacks on the Mueller investigation lying down.
Given the fact that Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker has stated he's not going to recuse himself, what can the incoming Democratic-controlled House of Representatives do to protect the Mueller probe from Matt Whitaker if he follows through on his published and televised comments of his antipathy towards Mueller and his probe?
Sure. Well, there are a number of things that they can do. Some of them can be undertaken before the Democrats take control of the House, and some of them can only happen when the Dems have the tools of oversight that they will gain starting in January. But in the meantime, both chambers should immediately pass the legislation, the bipartisan legislation that would protect Bob Mueller. The bill that moved through the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier this year has been introduced in both chambers and simply says that Mueller cannot be fired without cause. So that's something that we just need to put in place to make sure that he is protected. Still further, we'd like to see additional legislation put in place, which would insulate Mueller, protect him if Whitaker stays in place or if there's another attorney general who also wants to undermine the probe. Mueller should be given independence and insulated and given the choice to release the report if he writes one in his own time. There's a real precedent for this in the Watergate situation when Archibald Cox was fired and Leanne Jaworski was brought in. Robert Bork, who was the current AG at the time, issued an executive order to protect Leanne Jaworski, to insulate him and say that he had complete independence and Mueller could be given those same protections. So those are two things we'd like to see happen legislatively or through executive order, which can't happen anytime. Obviously, we'll have a better chance come January. And then in addition, in January, we'd like to see strong oversight. If Whitaker's still there, he needs to be the first witness that Nadler calls in the Judiciary Committee in the House.
Now, just to drill down a bit on what you talked about, there have been scenarios that if Matt Whitaker or some other Trump ally is head of the Department of Justice, there could be an effort to suppress any final report that comes out of the Mueller investigation. If that happens, there are many legal scholars out there who talk about a constitutional crisis. If the DOJ and the Trump White House basically say, we're going to lock away this Mueller report and no one will ever see it, that will certainly abrogate what I think majority of the nation feels should be done in terms of a full, fair, and open investigation of what the president and his campaign did or did not do in terms of collusion with the Russians during the 2016 election.
So that's completely right. And there's a reason that our fourth red line for our citizen activists is that exact thing. If the Mueller report is suppressed, if there isn't transparency in the findings, one thing is for sure, the public is very deserving of a final explanation of what happened. We've all watched the circus of the last 2 years and seen endless denials, claims of no collusion from the president. We deserve to know what Mueller has found. And we've seen the pretty impressive track record from what is public, the litany of indictments and charges. And so we need to know the rest. And I think are entitled to see it. If we don't, I imagine there will be massive outrage. And certainly the House will use all of the tools that they have to call for answers.
That was Lisa Gilbert, Vice President of Legislative Affairs with Public Citizen. For more analysis and commentary on Trump's firing of Jeff Sessions and threats against the Mueller probe, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The expected blue wave of Democratic Party victories on election night didn't materialize quite the way it was predicted during the early vote count in the eastern half of the U.S. But a week later, as results of close races trickled in, the party has gained 32 seats in the House thus far and appears headed to gain between 35 and 40 seats once all the votes are counted and validated. Initially, Democrats appear to be losing some key Senate races, but a week later, after Kristen Sinema was declared the winner in Arizona, Democrats will likely lose one or two seats rather than the three or four originally forecast. Lower down on the ballot, Democrats flipped 7 governorships, 6 state legislative chambers, and more than 300 state House and Senate seats on election night. With vote counts still underway in key races in Florida and Georgia, and several in California, Democrats won a larger landslide in 2018 than Republicans did in either 1994 or 2010. The diversity of Democratic candidates, with a record-breaking number of victories by women and people of color in 2018, is historic in and of itself. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Here he talks about his recent article titled, A Challenge to the New Blue Congress Govern as Progressives, where he argues that the incoming Democratic House majority should strongly advocate for popular progressive policy initiatives such as Medicare for All, a $15 minimum wage, and higher taxes on the nation's wealthiest citizens.
In a significant extent, the Democrats were able to flip seats, I think, in spite of the National Party, not because of it. There are a lot of independent progressive groups that did a tremendous amount of outreach targeted to specific congressional districts with some really good results. And even when there were some high-profile, strong progressive candidates that did not win, such as Beto O'Rourke running for Senate in Texas, such as, and we don't have the final results in, but probably Andrew Gillum, the gubernatorial candidate in Florida, has not won. We don't know that for sure. But those candidates in Texas, in Florida, also Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who may not have won that gubernatorial race, but also inspired many people at the grassroots to turn out, and that really is the key word. Turnout was greatly enhanced by these dynamic progressive candidates like O'Rourke, like Gillum, like Abrams, and that meant that people were also voting on down ballot positions that meant Republicans lost some very close races. So the dynamism is really coming from progressives across the board in this country. That's why people turn out. Who in particular am I referring to? I'm talking about young people who overwhelmingly vote against Republicans for Democrats when they vote, and people of color likewise when they vote. It's not enough to say we're going to vote against Republicans, as bad as they are, and they're surely atrocious, but to draw out people who are young, people of color who may feel understandably alienated from the political process, it's essential to give them somebody to vote for who's going to be on the ballot.
Recent polling has shown that the American people, by and large, support higher taxes on the wealthy, support Medicare for All, support a $15 minimum wage. With the House of Representatives now, the Democratic majority, what is their obligation to follow up on that agenda, given the fact that with a Republican-controlled Senate and the White House still under Donald Trump, pushing legislation forward is not really a viable option? But what kind of groundwork can be laid for a progressive agenda in these and many other areas over the next couple of years while the Democrats do maintain a majority in the House?
Well, I think groundwork is a good word, that a lot won't get accomplished until after the 2020 election. But it is possible to block some bad legislation because Democrats control the House starting in January, and also because of the sort of push-pull, to some extent, to be able to get some legislation passed and signed into law that's good. We should remember, for instance, that there's a large caucus in the House of Representatives called the Progressive Caucus. It now has around 80 members. And because the Republicans have lost the House, next year there are going to be 12 members of the Progressive Caucus who chair committees of the House and 30 others who control, by being chair, subcommittees of the House. That potentially is very powerful in terms of economic and social justice issues. And we found time and again, and unfortunately this was the case often during 8 years of the Obama administration, that grassroots progressives too often just defer to Democrats who are in Congress. Don't give them a push when they're dragging their feet. Don't confront them when they come home during town hall meetings and so forth. Really, the opposite needs to happen. Whether it's those dozen and 30 chairs of committees and subcommittees I mentioned in the House coming up, or whether it's any of the more than 200 Democrats in the House of Representatives come next year, we've got to be willing to confront and push them. Because you can bet your bottom dollar that Wall Street and the corporate lobbyists, they're already pushing those Democrats, as are corporate news media outlets and editorial writers and pundits. Don't go too fast. Don't move to the left. Defer to the center, whatever that might mean, which is basically the status quo that so many people reject. And that is a challenge ahead. Really, history is going to be made by people at the grassroots, depending on what we do and what we don't do.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online activist group RootsAction.org. Find a link to Solomon's recent article titled "A Challenge to the New Blue Congress, Governance Progressives, and Related Material" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A federal judge ruled on November 8th that the Trump administration violated several key environmental laws when it approved, as one of its first actions after taking office, TransCanada's proposed Keystone XL tar sands pipeline project. The judge blocked any construction on the pipeline and ordered the government to conduct a supplemental environmental impact statement, or EIS. This ruling follows the court's previous decision on August 15th to require additional analysis of the pipeline's new route through Nebraska, approved last year by the Nebraska Public Service Commission. The project, which would send 830,000 barrels a day of tar sands oil, the most polluting form of fossil fuel, across the U.S.-Canadian border, requires approval from the U.S. State Department. If built, the Keystone XL pipeline would cross Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska, before meeting up with TransCanada's existing pipeline system in the U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jared Margolis, a senior attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the six plaintiff organizations that filed a lawsuit against the pipeline in March 2017. The center first intervened in the case because the pipeline is located on the flyway of endangered whooping cranes. Here Margolis explains what the ruling from U.S. District Court Judge Brian Morris could mean for the future of the pipeline project.
What the court found was that the government didn't do a full analysis of the impacts that Keystone XL would have on the environment. And what we have is the National Environmental Policy Act requires agencies to undertake what they call a hard look at the consequences of the agencies approving a project like this. And here the State Department didn't take that hard look at issues regarding the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the project, the impacts of oil spills, and some other issues like that. And they also didn't account for the fact that the government determined under the Obama administration that this project was not in the national interest. And yet here the Trump administration reversed course and said that it was within the national interest without fully explaining that reversal in their decision. And that sends a really important message to the Trump administration, which says you can't just make these decisions without some support, without some acknowledgement of the impacts of those decisions.
So the ruling was that the State Department needs to do another environmental impact statement or add to the existing one?
So here they need to do what they call a supplemental environmental impact statement. That's a whole new document that supplements the existing environmental impact statement. That supplemental document is subject to the same public comment period and the same oversight that the initial environmental impact statement is subject to. So we'll have a whole full process here that looks at the supplemental issues that the court said need to be fully addressed.
Jared Margolis, I read that it's possible that rather than go down that road, the Trump administration might appeal this ruling.
Certainly, they could decide to appeal the ruling and take this to the Ninth Circuit. There's a couple of arguments they could make. The big one would be the government has taken the position here that the National Environmental Policy Act actually doesn't apply in this situation. Their argument is that this is a presidential decision. The permit that is being issued here is something that was created by an executive order, and their argument is that that therefore gives the president the authority, and the president isn't subject to the National Environmental Policy Act. The problem with that argument is that the decision is actually being made by the State Department here, and the State Department as an agency of the government is subject to the National Environmental Policy Act. And we went through this issue on what they call motions to dismiss early in this case, and the judge sided with us and agreed that as an agency, the State Department does have to follow the National Environmental Policy Act, and then, as you know, subsequently determined that they did not fully comply with that law. The government will then likely argue on appeal that the president's decision here, even though it was made by the State Department, isn't subject to NEPA, and we'll have to deal with that at the appellate level. But we don't know what they're going to appeal. We don't know if there's other aspects of the case they will appeal. We believe that we are correct on that point. We believe that the judge was correct in ruling in our favor on that point, and we think the Ninth Circuit will agree that the State Department should be making this decision with a full understanding of the risks involved, which requires an environmental impact statement under NEPA.
Either way, whether they go with a supplemental environmental impact statement, or EIS, or decide to appeal the judge's decision, what kind of delay do you think we're looking at?
It's difficult to say in terms of time frame. If they do a decent job, if they were actually going to address all of the issues that the judge is saying they need to address in a reasonable way, it will take likely up to a year or more to do that. If they appeal, it depends on the posture of the case. It depends on if they ask for review at the Ninth Circuit in a more expedited review, as they call it. We don't know if that'll occur. But yes, this is likely to delay any construction activities for at least 6 months to a year if we're going to be looking at this in a reasonable manner.
TransCanada says they're sticking with this project, which was first proposed 10 years ago and has run into fierce opposition from Indigenous groups, climate activists, and local residents in the path of the pipeline. Do you think it will get built?
You know, while they haven't made a decision yet, it seems, this is definitely going to make it harder for this project to ever get built. And we think we're confident that this is going to, hopefully result in this project being abandoned, because it's in everyone's real interest, except for the few people who are going to make money off of that project. It's in everyone's interest not to be tapping into these horrible tar sands. And it's an important point to remember that there are not very many jobs from this project. This is not benefiting America. This is Canadian product that's likely going to Asia. This is not in our interests. And to allow the construction of this devastating project across our country is simply, it's unconscionable.
That was Jared Margolis, a senior attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity. Learn more about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Carib Rhythms Radio in Tucker, Georgia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Man power. It has been over a generation since the U.S. Senate hearings on the sexual harassment charges of law professor Anita Hill against then-judge, now Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. A lot has changed since then, or has it? The French have a saying, plus ça change, or the more things change, the more they stay the same. The charges of sexual harassment now poised against the sitting judge and possible justice, Brett Kavanaugh, by a psychology professor, Dr. Christine M. Ford, of events that occurred over 30 years ago, shows us that things have changed very little. For power remains a mostly male prerogative, and women, unless they act as manlike as possible, are more often than not treated like children, seen and not heard. For at the nexus between law and power lies the courts, one of the last mighty bastions of male power. The remarkable Me Too movement may have enormous power in the realm of culture, think Hollywood, but law remains a largely male preserve still. Women, the majority of the U.S. population, are not the majority of political leaders, don't earn the highest incomes, and aren't paid wages equal to men. In other words, their power is quite limited. They are, however, the highest number of law students, so this may prove a coming day that they will dominate the field, but not today. Manpower still reigns in politics and law, and unless I miss my guess, in the next few days, we shall see Brett Kavanaugh don the dark robe of a junior justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. down the Constitution. It happened on the last Wednesday of August 2018. Around 8:30 p.m., the PA system announced a lockdown of the prison, apparently in response to a recent spate of staff sicknesses thought to be related to drugs. Even though the suspected cases occurred in prisons in the western part of Pennsylvania, the entire state system, almost 30 prisons, went into immediate lockdown. Lockdown means no movement in the prison except for staff. That means all prisoners are locked in their cells for 24 hours a day. All visits were canceled. Mail delivery and outgoing mail was canceled. Several days into this process, guards distributed a 3-page memo to prisoners announcing new rules allegedly designed to defeat drug smuggling. Among them, prisons will no longer receive mail, for all correspondence will be rerouted through an address in St. Petersburg, Florida. That office will scan and copy the mail and then send a digital copy back to Pennsylvania. Legal mail will be Xeroxed and a copy given to the prisoner named in the mail. For 3 months, no visitor can purchase food or photos for a prisoner, and no books can be ordered by a prisoner. The DOC, it appears, is having a temper tantrum, and it is engaged in war against all contact with the public. This sounds like the DOC's equivalent of reefer madness. This is, more than anything else, Pennsylvania's DOC's engagement in drug politics. It's a war against the prisoners, yes, but also a war against knowledge and ultimately the Constitution itself. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Indignation, awe, and rage. I learned a good deal from it and met people, amazing people, who I had never heard of. I've got to add another emotion, envy. Why? Because in Pennsylvania prisons, where some 51,000 plus souls reside, Dennis Bernstein's flashpoints are not heard. We're in Pennsylvania, 3,000 miles away. Also, there's no internet access in these joints, so the steering, soul-touching, and moving interviews with Dennis and his guests are lost to us. That is, until Follow the Money. Now that these remarkable interviews are available in print, the vast world of social, ecological, labor, gender, political, national insecurity, legal strategies are open to millions beyond Pacifica's frequencies. Here we see that Bernstein has one of the best jobs in the world. He talks to fascinating people from a wide and brilliant array of life. Most are engaged in some of the most challenging struggles of this era against entrenched state and corporate power. Here we see activists and participants in the battles against state and corporate snooping on the people, against the growing repression machine, especially versus black and brown bodies, against gender, sexual expression, dangerous border wars, global assaults on the world's peoples and environments, the horrors of Palestinian existence under the heels of the Zionist apartheid occupation, and much, much more. Another feeling, anger. Why anger, you wonder? I've learned of people's struggles that have been largely ignored by the complacent corporate media. Here, there are hundreds of untold stories that could and should be told by the corporate media. To this date, most of these stories remain untouched and untold. This is an immense disservice to the American public, proving beyond cavil that the nation's media is primarily the purveyor of infotainment to dazzle, distract, and delude viewers, readers, and listeners, not to inform them. So when you read these interviews and learn of these pivotal events in the life of the nation, how can you not get angry? How can you not feel that corporate news is little more than a basket of emptiness, of echoing fog? Bernstein's Flashpoints provides a powerful searchlight through that fog. It is common for people, especially young people, to pine for the good old days of the 60s. They often lament the lack of movements in the U.S. today. No one can read Follow the Money and come to such a conclusion ever again, for the nation is bursting with movements. For people are fighting with hope, imagination, and deep love against the forces of greed, exploitation, and expropriation by the minions of capitalism, racism, militarism, and unjust state power. Dennis Bernstein has brought some truly remarkable minds, voices, and hearts to his listening audiences at KTFK's Flashpoints. Now, these beautiful minds can speak to new audiences of readers, not only in prison, where, by the way, there are voracious readers, across the country, and indeed, worldwide. I found these interviews both enlightening and delightful. Thank you, Dennis. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, originally airing November 7th, 2014. Was Canada's involvement in the major conflicts of the 20th century truly about a valiant fight for freedom and democracy, as Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper has maintained in numerous public speeches? Who were the major players driving Canada and other countries into war? What were the political and economic forces that triggered and maintained World War I? How has that conflict shaped the world we live in today, and what lessons can be learned from that tragic conflict? On the occasion of Remembrance Week, and on the year marking the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, the Global Research News Hour attempts to shatter some of the myths surrounding the past conflicts in which Canada has become engaged with the help of activist and author Eve Engler, and with historian and author Jacques Powells. On today's program, Lest We Forget, Rethinking the War to End All Wars. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 7th, 2014. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. You can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. So, one of the two first international monitors on site saw conclusive evidence that the Malaysian plane had been hit by very, very strong machine gun fire, not by ground-based missile fire. Peter Hisenko's reconstruction of the downing of that airliner was here being essentially confirmed on site by one of the two first OSCE international monitors to arrive on site while the wreckage was still smoldering. Unlike a black box interpretation analysis long afterward by the Russian government, or by the British government, or by the Ukrainian government, each of which governments has a horse in this race, this testimony from Bosyrkiu is raw, independent, and comes from one of the two earliest witnesses to the physical evidence. That's powerfully authoritative testimony, and it happens to confirm pilot Peter Hisenko's theory of what happened. Bosyrkiu arrived there fast because he negotiated with the locals for the rest of the OSCE team, who were organizing to come later. Bosyrkiu speaks the local languages there, Ukrainian and Russian. That's from the article, "Evidence is now conclusive. Two Ukrainian government fighter jets shot down Malaysian Airlines MH17. It was not a Buk surface-to-air missile." By Eric Zeus, posted November 5th. The cause of the shooting down of Malaysian passenger plane MH17 on July 17th, while that plane was flying over the conflict zone during Ukraine's civil war, is becoming clearer and clearer, despite the rigorous continuing attempts by Western news media to cover it up and to hide from the public the evidence that clearly shows what brought down this airliner. The BBC had previously posted to their website on 23 July 2014, just 6 days after the event itself, a news report in Russian via their Russian service about the downing, but they quickly removed it without explanation. Fortunately, however, some Russian speakers had managed to download it before it was yanked, and one of those downloads is still up at YouTube, having been posted there on July 28th, with English subscripts and with the headline, "Ukraine Eyewitness Confirm Military Jet Flew Besides MH17 Airliner, : BBC Censors Video, 25 July 2014. So this valuable eyewitness testimony to the event is available despite Western news media or propaganda media, and the reason for the news suppression is clear from anyone who views that BBC report, which presents several eyewitnesses, all of whom were interviewed separately as individuals, not as a group, and yet all of whose testimonies report having observed the very same basic narrative of at least one military jet rising toward the airliner just before it came down. In other words, BBC had yanked this piece because it didn't confirm the West's storyline, which says that Ukrainian pro-Russian separatists fired a Buk ground-based missile at the airliner, thinking that the civilian plane was a Ukrainian government warplane about to bomb them and their families. That's from the article, "Western News Suppression About the Downing of MH17 Malaysian Jet" by Eric Zeus, posted November 6th. Today, an estimated 55% of U.S. oil production and all the production increase of the past several years comes from fracking for shale oil. With financing cut off because of economic risk amid falling oil prices, shale oil drillers will be forced to halt new drilling that is needed merely to maintain a steady oil output. The aggressive U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, its war against Syria's al-Assad regime, its hardball oil sanctions against Iran, its sanctions against Russian oil projects, its cynical toleration of ISIS in Iraqi oil regions, its refusal to intervene to stabilize the Libyan oil economy, but instead to tolerate disorder, are all premised on a cocky view in Washington that the USA is once again the king of oil in the world and can afford to play high-risk oil geopolitics. The official government agency responsible for advising the CIA, Department of Defense, State Department, and White House on energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, has issued projections of U.S. shale oil growth based on myths and lies. That has led the Obama White House to launch oil wars based on those same myths and lies about the rosy prospects of shale oil. That comes from the article, "The Collapse of Oil Prices. Has Washington Just Shot Itself in the Oily Foot?" by F. William Engdahl, posted November 6th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Briefly, the Navy is proposing to turn a large part of Washington's magnificent Olympic Peninsula, as well as a portion of northeastern Washington, into electronic warfare training ranges. A giant antenna resembling a house-sized golf ball will be installed at the naval station at Moclips, just outside the Quino Indian Reservation on the Olympic Peninsula. According to the data in the environmental assessment, I calculate that it will have an effective power of 5 million watts. Needless to say, the peace of the Olympic Peninsula will be destroyed forever. The radiation in both locations will impact predominantly Native Americans. That is from the article, "Electromagnetic Warfare Training Range to be Established in Washington State's Olympic Peninsula," by Arthur Furstenberg, posted November 5th, originally appearing at TakeBackYourPower.net. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In Canada, the annual Memorial Day known as Remembrance Day was conceived principally as an occasion to reflect on the sacrifices of soldiers who lost their lives while serving in military conflicts. It is commemorated on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, coinciding with the signing of the armistice in 1918, which marked the official end of World War I. Remembrance Day typically honors the service of military personnel in the 20th century conflicts in which Canada has participated. But what exactly was the role of Canada in those conflicts, and what does her military policy say about the values that Canada espouses? To discuss this, we're joined by Eve Engler. He is an activist and author of numerous books on Canadian foreign policy, including The Black Book on Canadian Foreign Policy, Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, and his latest, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. Thanks once again for joining us, Eve Engler.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, maybe we should go back to the First World War. Based on the research that you've done, what would you say was Canada's principal interest in becoming involved in that conflict?
Supporting the British Empire, mm-hmm. Very clearly, and this was the high time of imperialism, European imperialism across the globe. Particularly in Africa, and there was competition between the dominant imperial powers, Britain and France, and the up-and-coming imperial power, Germany, and it led to a major conflict where I think 600,000 Canadians end up fighting. Huge numbers of them end up dying and being injured, and probably almost everyone who went was damaged in one way or another, psychologically or physically. So it took a huge toll on the Canadians who went to fight, but it also took a huge toll on people from other countries. And I'm currently doing a book about Canada's role in Africa, and it was actually a Canadian who headed up the British. He was actually in charge of British and French troops in West Africa that conquered the Cameroons from Germany. So basically, they used World War I as a sort of pretext to capture more of West Africa. Both France and England did that, and it was a Canadian who was in charge of that. And it was Canadians who fought a number of different places in Africa during World War I. So it was there's no doubt that people, and many of them, some of them were at least, were conscripted, who went to go fight in World War I. But we have to also remember, to a large extent, in the case of World War I, most of it, early on at least, was voluntary, so people choosing to fight. And people were caught up by the glory of the empire and the glory of fighting for Britain's empire. And that's the main I think that's the main story of World War One. Today, it's gotten to the point of you'll hear things like Stephen Harper and others who talk about World War One as a fight against fascism or a fight against totalitarianism, or they sort of try to obscure what World War, they sort of bring World War One and World War Two sort of together in some way. But it was very clearly a completely destructive, useless war, where at one point there was over a year where they didn't move more than like 10 kilometers in France, where you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered over minuscule pieces of land. And the Canadian elite and the whole Canadian political culture very much supported this you know, brutal inter-imperial conflict.
I'm curious about the role at home, because I know that in Quebec there was resistance to what you know, or essentially the British Empire, when Quebecers don't necessarily identify themselves as you know, part and parcel of that empire. Canada is an independent country. What was the nature of the conversation during the war?
Well, it was incredible jingoism in most parts of the country in terms of favoring the war. Obviously, in Quebec, that was different. There was instances actually in Quebec. There was obviously lots of opposition to the war and opposition to conscription. But there was at times McGill students who went over to the from French universities and attacked the French universities, you know, so for being pacifistic or whatever. So sort of like sort of fascistic thugs, if you like, Anglophone thugs who were attacking perceived or actual anti-war kind of sentiment. You've got to remember that you know, someone like Ginger Goodwin out on the labor leader out on the West Coast was not 100% confirmed, but most of the historical evidence suggests was killed by police agents for his opposition to the war. So it was a brutal the state repression in terms of those who dissented was quite extreme. So you know, it's kind of particularly ironic to hear Harper talk about, you know, World War One is about fighting against totalitarianism, when in fact if anything, within Canada at least, World War One really heightened sort of totalitarian kind of instincts of the government. So I mean, that's, you know, as in recent weeks and months we've seen with what, you know, what's happened in Ottawa, and you know, the killing of the soldier in just outside of Montreal, that there's been a, you know, a growth of sort of jingoistic kind of rally behind the flag type of sentiment, but we're talking about a whole different scale during World War One, of just, you know, the extremeness of this was infinitely greater today. So in some ways we should be, you know, while there's still some major issues on the front of nationalistic jingoism and war today, in many ways it's less extreme than it was historically. And I think that's in part because of the anti-war movements, you know, tracing right back to World War One. And one other thing about, well, one side thing about World War One we have to remember also is that Canada sent troops to try to crush the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. You know, very, very hostile act to Russia, and hard to argue that it was, you know, and it was very much a sideshow to World War One. And even once World War One ended, they initially claimed they were sending the troops to get Russia to re-enter the war, which was never true. But even after World War One ended, the troops stayed for months. So you know, really completely showing that pretext was nonsense. But you know, there was also at the same time there were Canadians who refused to fight. You know, who were in the army, who refused to go to Russia to participate in undermining the attempts to change social conditions in Russia at that time. So there was credible jingoism and credible warmongering, but there was also signs of dissent and people refusing to follow orders that were leading to all kinds of destruction.
Now, what about World War II? Because that's seen as a more acceptable war. I mean, we fighting against the forces of fascism, Hitler, and of course, Italy. There was Mussolini and so on. So, whether or not it was a good thing or a bad thing, what was Canada's motivation in participating in that war?
I mean, it's clear that after the fact. Undermining and destroying Hitler and Nazism was a positive thing. Almost no one would argue, I think, against that. I would hope. Whether that was the initial motivation or how the Canadian motivation was sort of formed, was Canada trying to fight anti-Semitism? Was Canada trying to fight fascism? No. That was not the primary motivation of Canadian policymakers, and the primary motivation, as one book on World War II puts it very clearly, it was to support the British Empire, just like it was in World War I. The British Empire was challenged by Nazi expansionism, while the Nazis were focusing their ire against the Soviets. There was quite a bit of support for Hitler. Prime Minister Mackenzie King visits Berlin and Germany in the mid-1937, not very long before the war breaks out, and he is very clear in his diary, quite anti-Semitic, and very clear in his diary that he has all kinds of support for Hitler. He personally has, great deal of sympathy for Hitler. And I can't remember the exact quotes about how Hitler's role in lifting up the German peoples and stuff like that. Very, no ambiguity in terms of expressing sympathy for Hitler. So after the fact, it has been there's been an attempt to portray it as some sort of fight against the evils of Nazism in terms of anti-Semitism and in terms of the fascistic element of the system, but that there was actually a great deal of sympathy for those elements in Canada, and again, doing this book on Canada's role in Africa, there's throughout World War II, there's a complete acceptance by Canadian officials of British and French colonial rule in Africa, and there's Canadians who will fight, particularly in Northern Africa, and while they would say they were fighting to undermine Nazism or undermine Italian German as part of that war, at the same time they were propping up British French colonial rule. So from the perspective of Africans, for instance. Was World War II a good thing, or how does Canada's role in the war, how do you look at it from their perspective? So, clearly World War II, after the fact, the destruction of Nazism, positive. I don't think anyone or very few people would argue with that. Mm. Some of the ways the war was fought in terms of destroying German cities, that really it was civilians that were being targeted. I think there's some major questions there about major war crimes and stuff like that, the effect of World War II was ending the Nazism, at least, was obviously a very good thing.
Just to help secure that point, in just a few years previous, there was the Spanish Civil War, in which many Canadians tried to organize in support of the government against a fascist takeover. And just the way the Canadian government responded to Canadians whose sympathies were with the democratically elected government is quite telling about their attitudes towards the fight against fascism.
Yeah, no, that is an incredibly important part of the lead up, and that the response of Ottawa and London and others very much emboldened Mussolini and Hitler, because they poured huge amounts of weaponry into backing the Franco's fascist forces, and to a large extent, the Canadian political elite went along with that. They brought in the War Measures, not the War Measures Act, the Foreign Enlistment Act, to block, to make it illegal for Canadians to go fight on behalf of the democratic forces in Spain. That doesn't act. It's still on the books until today, but very selectively applied. So it's sort of, you know, focused on if you go fight for if you join to the tens of thousands of Canadians who joined American military to fight in Vietnam. That, of course, was not brought forward, but it was, you know, used to stop Canadians in 1936. So that's an important part of the lead up to World War II, and a, you know, sort of proof of how Ottawa was sympathetic to the British and to the Nazis and not antagonistic to Italian and German expansionism, so long as it was focused on undermining democratic and leftward forces, and to some extent the same is true with regards to Italy's invasion of Ethiopia in 1936, which was clearly against the League of Nations, clearly illegal. There was against the agreements that had been signed between Italy and Ethiopia going back a number of years, and it was a horrible slaughter of Ethiopians by the Italians, and there was a push at the League of Nations. There was actually a Canadian who was part of a commission the League of Nations created to bring in sanctions, particularly oil and coal sanctions against Italy. And even though it was actually a Canadian who was part of the one drafting this proposal, the Canadian government distanced itself from the proposal, and there was even actually some British support, but Canadian officials didn't want to move down that path of really sanctioning Italy, which again emboldened the fascistic forces and very much reinforced European colonialism in Africa. So if you look at the history leading up to World War II, it's very clear that, again, the motivation was not let's fight anti-Semitism, let's fight fascism. In fact, in two major instances, they had greatly, i.e., Spain and Ethiopia, they had greatly enabled Canada had greatly enabled the fascistic forces against a lot of opinion in the cases. In the case of Spain, there was obviously many Canadians who risked their life to go fight for democratic forces, but also in the case of, to a much lesser extent, but in the case of Ethiopia, there was, the CCF was pushing for the oil sanctions proposal in the House of Commons, and the government of the day was not having any of it. So yes, clearly. The history in the lead up to World War II shows that that the motivation was not what it's sort of being portrayed as today.
Now, Eve, we're on the eve of Remembrance Day, and of course, this is an occasion where, at least in the bygone era, I remember the sentiments "never again" and "lest we forget." If we were really true to those imperatives, what would you argue that ordinary citizens who really would like to see an end to war and injustice, what should they be doing, perhaps as an alternative to the traditional wearing of the poppy and attending Remembrance Day ceremonies? What do we need to do as citizens to secure a better world?
Well, I think the first thing, there is a campaign, there's the White Poppy campaign, basically says we should be recognizing all victims of war, not just the Canadians who fought and died, but also the Koreans who were killed in large numbers by Canadian forces in Korea in between 1950 and 1953. The Afghans who've been killed by Canadian and Western forces over the past decade or so. So to take a more holistic to
to take when you start recognizing the victims on everywhere, not just the Canadian soldiers, it softens the potential for the sort of jingoism that comes along with the poppy and Remembrance Day. Obviously, the Canadian soldiers who have been hurt and maimed in wars, there should be some degree of remembrance for what's happened to them. But when it becomes clearly part of this sort of jingoism of our side being hurt, and the implication there is that we're righteous and moral, and basically it gives the political leaders of the day the sort of ideological cover to continue with more wars. We're seeing that right now, where the reaction of Ottawa to 20 years of Iraq being bombed and occupied and having all kinds of they're having their politics be controlled and influenced and by Washington or London. The reaction to the Canadian political elite to recent developments in Iraq is to continue that trajectory of bombing and intervention and which I think to a large extent is what's brought the problems in Iraq that exist today, the rise of ISIS to Islamic State to where it is. So the option of more bombing is not the right option. So I think that a simple thing is to wear the white poppy. Here in Montreal, Cheikh Alaguer is actually organizing a little sort of action on Remembrance Day in terms of the white poppy campaign and drawing attention to the ongoing or the just started Canadian war in Iraq. So I think that those kind of initiatives are where people who are peace minded and who want to see an end to the destruction of war and the horrors of war for everyone. I think that's some of where people should focus their energies on.
Eve Engler, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Eve Engler is an activist and the author of a number of critiques of Canadian foreign policy, including The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, and his latest, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the start of the First World War. World War I was the war that was supposed to end all wars. Unfortunately, that hasn't been the case. But what exactly was World War I all about? What triggered it? And what were the forces that conspired to generate it? I'm joined right now by Jacques Pauwels. He is the author of The Myth of the Good War, America in the Second World War, and Beneath the Dust of Time, A History of the Names of Peoples and Places, and of an upcoming book dealing precisely with World War I. Jacques Pauwels, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure being here.
Was World War I in some sense an inevitable outcome from the growth of the Industrial Revolution, or was it just some sort of a strange historical idiosyncrasy that just got out of hand?
Well, Michael, I am not one who subscribes to the idea that the First World War broke out unexpectedly and against the will of most people, certainly not against the will of our leaders, as it's sometimes mentioned. Some authors speak of how our leaders sort of sleepwalked into the war. I don't believe that. Some people, some historians say that the war was a collective accident of history. You might say a rote accident of history. Others called it the great stupidity, the great collective stupidity, which means that it's overall to blame for whatever reason. I don't see that. I think the war was not an accident. I think it was in the air for a long time. I think the history of Europe in the 19th century and in the early 20th century was basically leading towards war for a number of reasons. In my book on the First World War, I actually pay a lot of attention to the 19th century because in many ways the First World War was the fruit, the product of that long 19th century. And it was also, of course, the mother, you might say, the First World War was also the mother of the shorter 20th century. But let's look for a moment at how the 19th century produced the Great War, the First World War. The 19th century was a century of revolutions and wars, wars and revolutions, starting with the French Revolution. Early, in other words, the 19th century has often been described as the long 19th century. It started in some ways with the French Revolution of 1789, which was followed by wars, including the Napoleonic Wars. Then there were revolutions in 1830 and 1848, which also basically led to the wars with the Russian armies occupying Poland and moving into Budapest and you name it. Then the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71 led to the Paris Commune, a pretty nasty little revolution, you could call it. And, of course, in 1905, Russia went to war with Japan, and that produced a revolution in Russia. And then you have the First World War, and that's a big war that produces a revolution in Russia again. So there is a dialectic here between war and revolution, where the one sort of causes the other one and vice versa. And I think we cannot look at World War One without looking at it in this context. It was a war that was also linked up with the idea of revolution. And here I should say right away that the leaders of Western European countries and also Central European countries, like Germany and, in fact, of Eastern European countries like Russia, the leaders of these countries, the French, the British, the Germans, the Russians, they really all wanted war for a number of reasons. They thought war was going to be going to resolve a lot of social and economic problems. And the great social problem war was supposed to resolve was the threat of revolution and the push towards democratization, which our leaders, being elitists and not in favor of democracy, we disliked very much. But they were particularly concerned about the specter of revolution. It seemed to them, in the years leading up to the 1914, that there was a race on, a race between war and revolution. And which would come first? That was a big question. If revolution comes first, it's the end of the, you might say, the civilization as the elites of Europe knew it. If, on the other hand, war would come first, it may put an end to the revolution. So that's really one of the reasons, and it's not the only one, there was an economic reason as well, why the elites of Europe, the French, the British, the Germans, the Russians, all of them really were hoping for a good war to clean the air, and actually a war would serve as antidote to social revolution. That was really one of the major, major reasons of war. So the fear of social revolution. And also, next to that, economic reasons. But maybe we can talk about that later on.
For sure. Are you talking about this war as a sort of like inoculation against these revolution, these social revolutions? Of course, there was the Bolshevik Revolution, which came along very shortly. What was the interplay between World War that war and the rise of the Bolsheviks?
Well, here we are dealing with the dialectic of war and revolution. Some historians prefer to talk about the First World War and stay away from the topic of the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, which was part two of the Russian Revolution, part one being the one in the spring of 1917, the Bolsheviks coming to power in October 1917. The war was intended by the elites, was wanted by the elites of Europe, was in many ways provoked by the elites of Europe, who were hoping that war would serve as an antidote to revolution. But in fact, it's one of the ironies of history that war produced exactly the opposite. Rather than putting an end to the specter of revolution, chasing away once and for all the specter of revolution, as war was supposed to have done, the war actually would end up producing the revolution. And that's a great irony in a sense, but it's understandable. If you know what the war actually ended up doing to people, instead of being short and victorious and basically ending up reinforcing the existing social political systems in Germany, Russia, Britain, France, and so on, you know, it basically undermined the loyalty of people to the established order. It undermined their faith in their leaders, in the political, religious leaders, and so on. It did all of that, and as a result of that, eventually it made many, many people in some countries more and other countries fewer, basically ready, eager, and willing to overthrow the old system. In other words, make a revolution. And these revolutions actually happened in quite a few countries. We shouldn't forget that. The revolution succeeded in Russia, where the Bolsheviks took control of it. But we should not forget that there was also a big revolution at the end of the war in Germany, which came close to succeeding and was had to be smothered in blood. And very few people realize that even in Great Britain, there was a kind of revolutionary situation at the end of 1918, at the beginning of 1919, with major disturbances and strikes and problems in cities like Liverpool and Glasgow and Belfast, even a mutiny in one of the ships of the Royal Navy and so on. And that problem could only be resolved by bringing in major social and political reforms, like an extension of the suffrage and bringing in the 8-hour workday and so on. These concessions were needed to basically defuse a revolutionary situation. So there is a direct causal relationship between the war, the First World War, and the revolution not only the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, but the revolutions in general and the revolutionary movements. And then the war also caused the reforms, a certain amount of democratization, which also the elites had hoped to stop before the war by means of war, but which, again, the war forced them to introduce even more democracy than before. The way I see it is that the war, the First World War, was not a war for democracy, as it was called by Wilson. It actually was much more a war against democracy. But, of course, you had to use slogans to sell the war to people. You could hardly tell people that it was a war against, you know, an attempt to give them more power and more input in government. So we had to pretend that it was for democracy. That's not really true. That's where rationalities were invented. It was told that it was the war to end all wars, and that wasn't true. And indeed, I think we also rationalized our entry into the war and our role in the war in many other ways. In the case of Canada, for example, the idea was conjured up that our contribution to the war made Canada really the nation it is today. You know, the idea that on the battlefield of Vimy, Canada was born. And I think this is absolute mythology. I think this is not true. I think a country like Canada did not need a war to be born. I mean, why does there have to be blood involved, really? Many countries have emerged from the scene of history without bloody wars and bloodshed and sacrifices like that. But, of course, that whole story is a way in which even historians, even today, rationalize the slaughter, rationalize the massacre by saying, well, something good came out of it. At least Canada was born on the battlefield. Therefore, the sacrifices were worthwhile. I don't believe that for a minute.
Now, it seems that central to the whole this world war dynamic was this issue of alliances. And you had, on the one hand, the Allies, which incorporated the United Kingdom, France, and the Russian Empire, and then the central powers of Germany and Austria-Hungary. And as a result of those alliances, you could have the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria, just triggering this whole, I don't know, domino effect that just spread beyond the region.
Well, I am not a big fan of the kind of theory that the war basically broke out because of the alliances.
Yeah.
It is true that the system of alliances helped or explained the ways in which the war was started. I believe the reason, the root causes for the war, is that the war was wanted by our elites and that they hoped to achieve great things on the social and even economic field. We can talk about economics later, I think we should. But the fact that there were military alliances, which automatically kicked in case of a threat of war, certainly didn't help the cause. It is known that, for example, France and Russia were allies, and that if one was going to be involved in a war against Germany, that the other one was automatically going to take part. There's no doubt about it. But the fact is that the assassination in Sarajevo was used as an opportunity to start a war which people wanted. I don't for a minute believe, and I think it's silly to believe, that the assassination in Sarajevo, which by itself was very unimportant, really was the cause of the war. It was simply the pretext which countries whose leaders wanted to go to war needed to actually go to war. And at that stage, the alliance system kicked in. It is true that having allies, the alliance system also caused our leaders who wanted war to want war sooner rather than later. And let me clarify that with the example of France, for example. France, the leaders of France wanted a war against Germany, if only to get Alsace-Lorraine back, but that's not was by no means the only reason. The leaders of France knew that France alone could never defeat Germany militarily. It was impossible. So France needed help from a big friend. That big friend they found in Russia. Russia, which
whose power, whose military power, was highly overestimated before the First World War. So France thought, with Russia on our side, we can beat Germany. Now, in fact, there's no way that we could lose against Germany with the mighty Russians on our side. As I mentioned, they overestimated the power of Russia in 1914, as much as in 1941 the Germans would underestimate the power, the military power of the Soviet Union. So in France then, in 1911, 1912, 1913, and in 1914, they're counting on the big Russian bear to help them, you know, kick the butt of the German eagle, so to speak. But there's a big concern here. Because the alliance between Republican France and authoritarian Tsarist Russia is not a natural alliance. It's actually, it goes against nature. France was the most democratic country in Europe at that time, and Russia the most authoritarian, the most undemocratic. And would that alliance survive the death of the Tsar and the arrival of a new Tsar who might be less Francophile, for example? Big question. Also, might Russia not go through a revolution again as it did in 1905, which might overthrow the Tsarist system and thereby also basically put an end to the alliance with France, which is exactly what would happen in 1917. The Bolsheviks would come to power and would pull Russia out of the war, causing great problems for France and her allies, because it would allow the Germans to turn an entire army against the Western allies. So the French were concerned that the alliance of Russia might not last forever. Therefore, the French generals, in the months before the First World War, were putting pressure on the political leaders to start this damn war as soon as possible, while we can still count on the Russian bear. Because if, for some reason, the Russian bear ceases to be our ally, we can forget beating Germany in the war. So, therefore, better war sooner rather than later.
There are areas of the world which are very rich in resources, and that we could see these imperial powers. And I know Vladimir Lenin, among others, said that this is essentially a war of imperialism. My paraphrase.
Yes, well, Lenin observed what was happening, and he wrote his famous book, on imperialism in 1916, actually drawing conclusions from what he saw happening in 1914 and the way he understood the war to have, you know, reasons for the war, why it happened. Well, let's talk about countries and territories with resources. It's a fact that up to 1914, there was keen competition between major industrial powers. The ones that would be involved in the war. Great Britain was the greatest industrial power of much of the 19th century, but felt very challenged by the rising star, which was Germany, happened to be. France was still an industrial power, but you know, getting less to be less so and fearing the continued growth of Germany. And they were all looking at each other, all wanting to compete, and everybody wanted to sort of have advantages for what sometimes is called their national economies. Today, the economies are much more intertwined internationally than they were then, 100 years ago. This internationalization had not gone as far yet. And it was believed that every industrial power needed the kind of territories for which they could use as exclusive markets for their products and where they could find cheap raw materials which useful for their industry, such as copper or rubber or whatever, and also cheap labor like the coolies the British used to build railways and do other dirty work and wherever it was needed. And so it was believed that without such territories at your service, you know, to be used exclusively as you saw fit, you know, and to basically get an advantage against the competition, that you wouldn't be able to compete effectively and that you may well fall by the wayside and lose out in this sort of rat race, you might say, among the leading industrial powers, or as Lenin would have put it, imperialist powers. So everybody was looking for, usually it was colonies. That was where the good stuff was. You know, even a little country like Belgium had the Congo where there was plenty of copper, for example. Well, Germany felt very underprivileged because Germany didn't have rich, important, and big African colonies. They had a piece of the Kalahari Desert and had some of the steppes of the wonderful region of Mount Kilimanjaro, which is great for sightseeing to see animals, but not so wonderful for resources, if you know what I mean. So they all wanted more territories, colonies, and not only colonies, but territories even within Europe. For example, Germany wanted some of the goodies of Eastern Europe. For example, the rich agricultural land of Ukraine they had their eyes on. And that's important because Ukraine, of course, has been in the news a lot recently, and it's involved some of the same considerations. You know, who's going to get the benefit of the rich agricultural lands and its products, you know, of the Ukraine? But there were particular reasons, particular products which were very much in demand and which certain imperial powers really wanted to lay their hands on. And I'm thinking here one raw material that was in great demand, became in great demand around 1900, was the oil. Because, for example, the Navy, the British Royal Navy, was switching from firing the ships with the boats with coal to oil. Now, Britain had had lots of coal, no problem, but oil, there was no oil in Britain. So Britain had to buy its oil from the United States, which was a rival in the rat race among industrial countries. And then they realized there was oil to be had in Mesopotamia, which was part of the Ottoman Empire. So we have to have the oil of Mesopotamia. That's, by the way, today Iraq. So we have to have it, but and that shouldn't be a problem because the Ottoman Empire was the weak man of Europe, as it was called, not only Europe, but also the Middle East. And it shouldn't be a big deal to grab a piece of territory. We had done it before. Egypt was part of the Ottoman Empire, and Tunisia had been part of the Ottoman Empire, had been pocketed by the French. So why couldn't we grab Mesopotamia? But the problem is that the Ottoman Empire is an ally of Germany. And if we were to war against Mesopotamia, you're going to have war against Germany. Well, so be it. In fact, the concern to have oil was very important, was extremely important, especially since the alliance between the Ottoman Empire and Germany and the common project, the Baghdad Railway, a railway from Berlin via Constantinople to Baghdad, opened up the perspective that the oil of Mesopotamia would flow to German ports and basically be used to fuel the German Navy rather than our Navy, and that would be a catastrophe. So it couldn't happen again. Time was seemingly against us, so we had to have that oil badly. And if it meant war against the Ottoman Empire, that's too bad, so sad. And if it means war against Germany, well, damn it, we have to have war against Germany too. And that's why Britain in those years actually approaches France and Russia, mighty partners, who can actually help to defeat Germany on land, while we send our troops from India to land in Basra and take Mesopotamia, which is exactly what happened during the First World War. You know, the British sent only a relatively small army to France and Belgium, but the bulk of their army actually went from India directly to Mesopotamia and fought in the Middle East against the Ottoman Turks. And what happened after victory, Great Britain basically pocketed much of the Middle East, especially the oil-rich regions. And that was a major concern. And that was the reason for approaching France and Russia and becoming allies with them. Because until 1900, France was the enemy and Russia was an enemy. And actually, Britain had better relations with Germany. So all that changed because of oil. And by the way, not only oil, but rubber was also important. But you don't want to get into too much details here. You could get sidetracked.
Well, okay, Jacques Pauls, what about, like, with the conclusion of the war, there is, of course, as you were pointing to like a major shakeup, a realignment. So, I mean, we had the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire is pretty much coming to an end. United States becoming much more robust. What would you say are some of the other major developments coming out of this conflict that's served to shape the direction in which the world has taken?
Politically
and economically.
To analyze the situation. I mean, certainly the map of Europe had changed big time. Some major empires had simply vanished. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was no more, and instead of that, you had a mosaic of little countries like Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and Hungary and little Austria, and they had a new country called Yugoslavia, which has been broken up ever since. So that actually what was once one big part of Central Europe under one umbrella of the Habsburgs, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, today is a mosaic of countries which has caused some problems. The wars in Yugoslavia come to mind, for example. I mean, Bismarck famously said about that, about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that if it didn't exist, somebody would have to invent it. He was joking in a way, but he was a little bit right in that at least it kept these people together and it kept them from flying at each other's throats. Now, whether that would have worked in the long run is a different question, of course. But there are other ways in which the First World War then influenced the 20th century, became the mother of the 20th century. And I think more importantly is to look at it at the social level. I told you at first that, as I see it, that the war was wanted because it was supposed to serve as an antidote to revolution. It was supposed to be a way to stop the democratization in which the elites of Europe had no interest whatsoever. They did not like democracy at all, contrary to what we now sometimes seem to think. And the those expected economic advantages. But on the social level, then they expected the war to chase away once and for all the specter of revolution and put a stop to this nonsense of a development towards more democracy, the democratization. Oddly enough, what happened is that the war produced the opposite. The war produced a revolution, and that revolution succeeded in Russia. And the war also made it necessary to avoid revolution in countries such as Germany and Belgium and Britain to introduce major democratic reforms, not only political reforms like widening the right to suffrage, the right to vote, to include more of the lower classes, the masses. It also involved social democratization, for example, introduction of the eight-hour day as opposed to having people work, many more hours than eight in one day, as had been the case in the 20th century. So the elites, essentially, were very disappointed that the war that they had unleashed in high hopes of gaining from it actually produced losses from their perspective. But it would be nice to think that the elites simply said, okay, well, that's just the way it goes, too bad, so sad. But no, they were not going to put up with that. They were looking out for an opportunity to undo these concessions, to make up for these losses. And that means, first of all, wiping out the revolution, which was now incarnated in the form of the Soviet Union, and secondly, still find a way to roll back the democratization, especially those reforms that were introduced after the war. And that crystallized in movements which we now describe as fascism. Because fascism was a way in which we could annul democracy, essentially, bring in dictators who are going to basically do things we want to do, and above all, a fascist dictator who's going to wipe out the revolution. In this case, the revolution in the form of the Soviet Union. And that, of course, was the German dictator. That was Hitler who was going to do that job. At the same time, the rivalry among the imperial powers still continued. I mean, the war, while it gave advantages to Britain, for example, possession of the oil fields in the Middle East, and it gave advantages and more leverage to the United States, especially with respect to goings on in Europe, the war did not resolve the issue. The competition remained and became even ever before. The one big loser in the imperial, you might say, the imperialist rat race was Germany. But Germany was still strong enough to remain a major player. And as a result of that, the issue of, you might say, who was going to be number one, who would be the winners in the race among national economies, among industrial powers, that's still being an open question. And in a sense, the Second World War is more of the same as the First World War. The idea was still to settle the issue as to who would get what in terms of of areas with resources such as oil and rubber and so forth, and also what was going to happen, how could we destroy the revolution, in this case the Soviet Union, and not the Germany, of course. That was the country, the power that was supposed to wipe out the Soviet Union. And when the Nazis actually prepared to invade the Soviet Union, there was a lot of sympathy for their cause in Great Britain and in the United States. You shouldn't underestimate that. Some people were disappointed that Hitler didn't wipe out the Soviet Union, that he failed in his great mission of life to destroy the Soviet Union, which basically the country, the cradle of the revolution.
Okay, just maybe one last question. Here we are 100 years after the start of World War I, and we're still sitting in the shadow of that great conflict. What would you say briefly would be the main aspects of the war that we should learn lessons from in order to that we never again repeat the mistakes of the past?
One obvious lesson, I think, it should be obvious, but somewhere it seems to be one that our leaders never learn, is that wars, that people can expect wonderful things of wars, but that never works out, that they never work out the way they're supposed to. That your plans never work perfectly, and the objectives you hope to achieve somehow are never achieved. I'm thinking of the First World War, the great plans of the Germans, the Schlieffen Plan, you could throw that in the paper basket after a few months, and the French plans were already thrown in the paper basket earlier. But not only that, the idea that the elites had, and they were convinced that a war would solve their problems. By the way, these ideas they got from intellectuals of that time, like Nietzsche, for example, and the social Darwinists, who thought war was a wonderful remedy for social problems. And if that didn't work out, instead of preventing the revolution, it produced a revolution. Instead of enabling them to put an end to democratization, it forced them to introduce even more democratic reforms after the war. So one of the lessons should be that war is going to give you nasty surprises. It's not going to work out the way you think. And here a recent example of that is George Bush's war when he sent the Marines into Saddam Hussein's Iraq in 2003, and after a few weeks proudly proclaimed victory. Well, it's now more than 10 years later, and we're still fighting in Iraq, and there's no end to the misery. And even though Bush thought he had basically achieved the wonderful thing, and from now on there would be peace in the Middle East and democracy and all that. And none of that happened. In fact, I would argue that the situation in the Middle East today is far worse than it was in 2003 when Saddam Hussein was still ruling Iraq and when Gaddafi was still ruling Libya, which is North Africa, the Middle East, but you get the point. So that the wars hold massive surprises for people who think they can benefit from it. And oddly enough, it's also true that the problems in the Middle East, of course, we can trace back right to the First World War, when the Ottoman Empire was broken up, as the Austro-Hungarian Empire was broken up, and there emerged a mosaic of countries, mostly controlled by Western powers such as Britain and France. France controlled Syria and Lebanon, and Britain controlled Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Kuwait and Palestine, later on to become Israel. And we know what kind of problems all that led to. You, in a way, you could have said, Bismarck could have said the same thing about the Ottoman Empire that he said about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that if it didn't exist, one should have invented it. I mean, I have no sympathy for the Ottomans. I think it was an obsolete kind of system and certainly far cry from the democracy, which we'd all like to see. But you didn't have those terrible wars and terrible things that are happening in the Middle East now under the Ottomans. Mm. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways in which we can now look at what's going on in the world and understand it better by seeking to understand the First World War.
Jack Powles, thank you very much for sharing your perspectives on this conflict with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jack Powles is a Belgian-born Canadian historian and author of the 2000 book, The Myth of the Good War, America in the Second World War. He has a French-language book on the World War I available now. An English version will be available in 2015. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca.